I'd like to bring the Environment, Energy, Natural Resource Committee to order. Members, we're going to convene this morning until our regular time at 10 o'clock, and then we will, our plan is to recess, reconvene tonight when session is over, and we will, if we don't get done by 10 o'clock, we won't go past 10 o'clock tonight. We'll come back tomorrow morning at 8:15. At 9, excuse me. I guess on Fridays we don't start as early. But I'm hopeful that we will finish today, even potentially. Maybe we can get through this morning, but I've been overly optimistic before. Why don't we first, Representative Quam, will you move the minutes of our previous meeting?
Mr. Chair, yes, I'd like to move the minutes.
Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. First, members, I would like to move House File 2164 to pass and go to GovOps. There is the A1 amendment to get, I'm sorry, first we have the DE1 amendment, and then after we adopt that, I would like to adopt the A1. Why don't we have Ms. Taylor walk through both the bill and the amendment before we adopt them, and then it's my thought that we would have both the MPCA, DNR, and I see Director Jasky here also, and Bowser can give agencies input on the bill. A lot of it is agency stuff. Some of it is, or a number of provisions are different members' bills in here, and some of them modified to the way the bills were presented as we learned more in our informational meeting. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed last night the amendments, and we have a huge amendment here, so I was just wondering who was going to speak for the trees. The bill just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Representative Hansen, both Representative Dill and I speak for the trees, and we like trees, and the more trees, the better. And in this bill, we do a number of things, including creating a children's forest, which is for the trees. So additional discussion on the layout, and depending on how things go, I think it's reasonable to think we can get done today. I don't know if we can possibly finish this morning, but we will. I would like to move the House File 2164 DE1 amendment to get the bill ready to be discussed. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Okay. The bill is before us in the DE1 form. And why don't, Ms. Taylor, if you would walk through it and then walk through the A1 after you walk through the bill, then we'll, after that, we'll adopt or make a motion to adopt the A1. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll be working off the DE1 amendment. Section 1 is a new section, and it's the first of several that has to do with the Executive Council and removing some of their authority over DNR-type transactions. In this first section, would remove their authority over awarding iron ore leases and approval of certain mineral rules. The next section is from the DNR policy bill, allowing advances in certain cases. Section 3 is from Representative Torkelson's bill, and if you look on page 3, that's where the changes are, and this is the 60-day auto approval for minor permits. Section 4 is from Representative Powell's bill, and this would provide game and fish licenses in the event of a shutdown. Section 5 is from Representative Guineas's bill, limiting purchases to 20% above the county assessor's estimated market value. Section 6 is the first of a number of sections from Representative Anderson's bill regarding DNR general permits. Section 7 is from the DNR policy bill regarding allowing easements on school trust lands. Section 8, another DNR policy bill, and this was just removing a report. Section 9, also from the DNR policy bill regarding apprentice riders, Section 10, also from the DNR policy bill. This was just a technical clarification. Section 11 and I think also 12, these are additional sections, but they just, they're requested by the DNR regarding some AIS technical clarifications that they had wanted. Then moving to Section 13 on page 10, this is another section from the DNR policy bill regarding AIS. It's Section 14. This was the section that allowed delegation of certain authorities, inspection authorities. Section 15 is from the DNR policy bill. This is the civil penalty section, but if you'll notice that the increase in civil penalties has been removed. And then if you look on page 13, you'll see that the doubling for second offenses has been retained. Section 16, also from the DNR policy bill. Section 17, this is from the chair's House File 2371. This would provide the state parks to be open if there was another government shutdown. Section 18 is from the DNR policy bill, as is 19. Section 20 is from House File 2257 by Representative Bills. This is providing the zoo to be open in the event of a shutdown. Section 21, also from the DNR policy bill, this is the AIS prevention program. You'll notice that the requirement to actually have the trailer decal has been removed, but the program is retained. Section 22, this is a technical clarification from the DNR policy bill. Section 23 on page 17, this is another section regarding the Executive Council, and this would remove their approval authority over certain timber sales. Section 24, this is from the DNR policy bill. This is from the lands article. This would allow them to sell lands bordering water. Section 25 on page 18 is a kind of a combination of a DNR policy provision from the lands bill and then some new language from the regarding the Executive Council removing their approval of certain leases. Section 26 is another section on the Executive Council. This removes their authority to award certain mineral leases in conjunction with the DNR. As is Section 27 also removes their approval of certain iron ore and taconite leases. On page 20, Section 28, another Executive Council, actually these three sections are, and they all remove various authorities and approvals over iron ore leases. Section 31, this is related to the Executive Council, but it allows the DNR to establish a filing fee for certain non-ferrous and other mineral leases outside of iron ore. And then Section 32 requires them to establish some rental rates as well regarding those leases. Section 33 is another section from the DNR's General Permit Authority Bill. Section 34 is another DNR policy provision. That's a technical clarification. Section 35, another section from the DNR policy bill on VHS. Section 36, this is a section from the PCA's policy bill. It's one of several sections that consolidates and modifies and eliminates certain reporting requirements. Section 37 is from, actually, 37 through 47, I believe, are sections from Representative Torkelson's local water management bill, and these are all as they were as we heard them in committee. So if you want to skip ahead to page, I'm finding that out. It'd be at the bottom of page 28. And this section 48, this is from McElfatrick's bill, and this is the section that removes the deed restriction requirement for certain wetland restorations on ag lands. And you'll see the section's sort of long, so we'll skip to section 49. This is the de minimis section, and you'll notice that there has been some changes, and this is some compromise language. Section 50 is also from Representative McElfetrick's bill, and this is as it was introduced. This is about the new wetland baking program option. As is Section 51, this is about the Federal Clean Water Act and working with the Corps and the EPA. Section 52 is another section from the general permit, as is 53. On the bottom of page 35, Section 54, this is from Representative O'Driscoll's bill, as is Section 55, and this is the compromise language we heard on Tuesday. On page 37, Section 56, and actually through Section 62, these are all sections from the DNR's general permits bill. So if you want to skip ahead to page 39, this is another Section 63 is another section from the PCFA policy regarding reports. Section 64 is from Representative Torkelson's bill regarding the water quality standards. Section 65 is another PCA policy provision regarding reports. Section 66 is the section from Torkelson's bill on the dedicating the PCA fines to the general fund rather than the environmental fund. Section 67 is another PCA policy provision regarding the reports. And Section 68 also has some more reporting, as is 69 and 70 on the 43. And then if you want to skip ahead to 45, Section 71, this is another section from the PCA policy bill, and this is regarding the county recycling goals. Section 72, more PCA policy provisions on reporting. 73 and 74 as well. 74 also removes authority from the PCA to the public safety for that program. But this is all as it was in the policy bill when we first heard it. Section 75 also from the PCA policy bill regarding reporting. Sections 76, 77, 78, 79, 80, and 81, these are all from Representative Torkelson's bill, and this was regarding the change in the MPCA Citizens Board and sort of making some technical clarifications and then removing their duties. Section 82, this is another provision from Representative Torkelson's bill regarding the 60-day auto approval of minor permits, and this is for the PCA. The previous one had been for the DNR. Section 83 is from the PCA policy bill. This is extension of certain open air swine provisions. Section 84 is another, and so is 85, sections from the PCA policy bill on reporting. Section 86, there's a technical provision from the PCA policy bill, and then there's also some new changes. And if you want to go to page 53, lines 53.18 and 53.20, is the first of those is providing another option for RGUs to publish notice in newspapers rather than waiting for the EQB monitor for EAW notices. And then if you want to skip ahead to page 55, there's some additional new language. This is allowing for joint hearings when an EIS required as part of the project, there's permits that are required from two or more agencies. And then on page 56, section 87 is from Torkelson's bill on duplicate permit information. Sections 88 and 89, these are PCA policy provisions regarding reporting. As is section 90 on page 57 and section 91 as well. Section 92, this is from the DNR policy bill, also removing some reporting requirements. And if you want to skip ahead to page 60, this is also from the DNR policy bill. This is making some modifications to a DNR project using LCCMR funding. And page 62, this is another provision from the DNR policy. It's another removal of a report. If you look on page 63, that's where the language is. Section 95. This is from the DNR policy bill. This is on the some changes to the LaSalle Lake State Park legislation. Section 96 is a new section. This would require a report on the long-term future of the state parks and rec areas and trails and state forest day use areas. Section 97, this is a new section. This is some extensions of some LCCMR recommended projects that are being requested by the LCCMR. Section 98 is a new report. This would require the EQB to report back to the governor and the legislature on environmental review and specifically reviewing the mandatory EIS and EAW categories. Section 99, this is regarding the Executive Council. It's providing some rulemaking exceptions for the DNR when they establish the rental rates and the filing fees that we saw earlier. Section 100 is a rulemaking exception for the EQB to comply with the new RGU notice regarding the notice of EAWs. And then Section 101 is the repealers. The majority of them are PCA reporting and DNR reports. There are a few new ones, which I'll go over. If you look on 6629, 86B.81, subdivisions 1 and 2, that's actually a technical error, and you'll see in A1 that those will be taken out. But on line 66.31, laws 2011, chapter 107, section 105, this removes the temporary enforcement regarding the boat AIS rules decal that was passed last session. And then 116.02, subdivision 7, 6 and 7, this is from Torkelson's bill from the Citizens MPCA Board. And then 103G.705, this is from the DNR policy bill regarding a loan program. And then if you look at the top of page 67, you'll see some additional repealers that are new, 86B.508. This is another provision on the AIS rules decal required, as is 86B.81, subdivision 1A. And that concludes the DE1. Would you like me to continue with the A1 then?
That would be fine, Ms. Taylor. Why don't you go through the A1?
Mr. Chair, members, this is the A1 amendment. And 1.3 is a technical correction being requested by the DNR. This would take out contracts from that advance payment provision allowing grants and contracts to be paid in advance. The new sections 11 and 12 are also requested by the DNR. Section 11 would require, those moving boats at yacht clubs and boat clubs to also be subject to the service provider requirements requiring AIS training and certification, I believe. Section 12 is another section by the DNR, and this they suggest is necessary to allow catfish anglers to continue to harvest and use bait on infested waters. If you go to page 2, starting on 2.17 is another DNR request. This is a technical change regarding AIS provisions. Starting on 2.24, this is a modified version of the McFarland bill. This establishes the Children's State Forest and would make the BWCA exchange proposal an exchange-only proposal. And then if you look on page 3, subdivision 3 establishes priorities for identifying lands to be exchanged. And the sale provisions have been moved, but there is still some condemnation authority if necessary, if you look on page 4 and the new section 30. Section 36, starting on line 4.27, this is from Ruka Venus House File 817 regarding the minerals management account. Page 5, the new section 30, concrete washout. This is the first of three provisions that address some concrete wastewater issue, and there, I don't know if there's testimony to follow, but someone can probably provide more information than I can. section, or on line 5.12, this is some clarifying language regarding the water quality standards not being more restrictive than federal water quality standards. Section 74 is a new requirement. This would require the consolidation of various PCA reports under chapters 115A and 115D. Section 91, this is another one related to that concrete provision. And if on page 6, the new section 92, this is a new provision that would exempt certain manure digesters from air emissions permits. Lines 6.9 through 6.13, this is some replacement language for the new EQB monitor alternative for notice that was we went through in the bill. Section 98 is another provision on the concrete. The new section 100 on the bottom of 6, this is a PCA technical change they requested regarding reporting. Moving ahead to page 7, the new section 102, this is a new provision that would limit the bond requirements that DNR impose on surveyors working on state lands to $1 million. And then there's actually a technical error on 7.31. The section heading has been lost, so this the language starting notwithstanding is actually a new section, and this would has to do with the beneficial reuse of wastewater provision and providing some additional flexibility for Elk River in that program. And then on the bottom of page 7.36, this is the repealer fix that I had mentioned when we were reviewing the repealers. And that concludes the A1 amendment, and then I can provide you a technical fix for that section heading that I just mentioned.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Good job. It's always good that somebody can explain it that understands it. Members, what I'd like to do is I'd like to move the A1, but I'm not going to ask us to adopt it yet because there's a number of provisions, a number of different bills included in the A1 that we need to take testimony and hear from, and then I would like to move the A1. I think we'll questions to that point. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think it is good to have testimony on some of these things that have just appeared overnight. There's been no bill, there's been no hearing, and all of a sudden we've got an amendment here with some significant new things. So I'm assuming that the folks who are going to testify probably knew about the amendment coming, but I think we're making bad policy here by throwing some major things into a bill to move out today.
Representative Hansen, to that point, just to make sure that folks are aware, is there anything in particular, any of the provisions in the A1 that you want to make sure that people know so when we come back, if there is some folks that you believe might not have got the posting last night in particular?
Mr. Chair, I think any of the concrete information, I don't remember hearing anything about proposals like that. The Children's Forest, I know we heard Representative McFarland's proposal, but this appears to have some significant changes to that. The state bonds insurance one appears to be new. The manure digesters, I know you referenced that in some testimony, but I don't think we had a bill on that. So almost the whole A1 amendment is pretty significant in terms of new information.
Well, thank you. And those are, that's a great point, Representative Hansen. Those are the ones that we need to hear from. I know MnDOT is here in regards to that bill that was referred to our committee yesterday on the floor. Because it applies to this committee and it's appropriate that we hear about that bill, even though it is a MnDOT bill. It certainly is an environmental issue that we need to deal with. And the other ones we will go through that you've mentioned. The first one I think I would like to do is, as you mentioned, we heard from Representative McFarland in regards to the school trust issue. Representative Rukavina, if you could come to the testifier table, and maybe you could, or Representative Dill, I don't know which one of you want to go through basically what this proposal is. And members, that would be starting on page 2, line 24, creation of the Children's Forest deals with the 93,000 plus acres of land in the Boundary Waters and a proposal to move that issue forward, something that hasn't happened since Representative Rukavina, you and I were at UMD, which happens to have been in the early 70s. Representative Rukavina, welcome. If you could explain what we our proposal is in regards to the Children's Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you stated, in the when the Boundary Waters became a wilderness area, our ability to generate money for the school children off of their trust lands disappeared. And so what this is attempting to do is basically trade the 93,260 acres of permanent school fund land in the Boundary Waters for the 93,160 acres of permanent school fund land in the Masaba Purchase, it's called, of the Superior National Forest, which is an unattached portion of the Superior National Forest that runs from Bowabic to north of Bowabic to the Itasca County line. There's also, Mr. Chair, about 18,450 acres of acquired land in the Boundary Waters that the state owns, and another 10,500 acres of county land, county tax forfeited land. So basically, with the language that you have and the other townships that are there alongside the Masaba Purchase, you have about an equal acre-for-acre exchange, which I think would be a huge benefit for the school trust and much easier to accomplish with the federal government than to start trying to figure out this 40 for that 40 or and money and trying to get some money, because I don't think we're going to get any money with the given the situation out in Washington, D.C. So I think it would be a really good deal for the school kids. And, Mr. Chair, I think you need a little oral amendment here to this language on line 3.6, and I'll have Representative Dill explain that.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And have you actually moved the amendment?
We have moved the amendment. We have not voted on the amendment. Maybe I'll formalize. I want to move the H2164A1 amendment to get it before us in case we didn't, Representative Dill. We are not going to vote on it. As Representative Hansen said, there's a number of provisions in here that have been before us.
I got that.
All that. Go ahead. Representative Dill.
Okay. So at some point, if it's appropriate now, I'd like to add some clarification language in the amendment.
Representative Dill, to your oral amendment.
Okay. On line 3.6, following the word the before the word Masaba, it should read, in the Superior National Forest Masaba Purchase Unit in St. Louis County. And then on line 3.7, following the word, or amending the word these to the following townships in St. Louis County. And the purpose of that oral amendment, Mr. Chair, is those townships that are listed specifically on lines 3.8 through 3.11 are not within the Superior, not within the Masaba Trust Unit. They are townships that are located in another part of St. Louis County. So it should read, when it's finished, line 3.6, starting with the word following, which is in the document already, following areas in the Superior National Forest Masaba Purchase Unit in St. Louis County in the following townships in St. Louis County. Trying to clarify that these townships are separate from the Masaba Purchase Unit. And I ask Ms. Taylor then if she understands the purpose of the oral amendment.
Ms. Taylor, to Representative Dill's oral amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I do understand.
Thank you. Questions to Representative Dill's oral amendment? That was a snafu that we, I thought we got it fixed, but in the effort to make sure the public saw this last night, we missed it. Representative Rucavino, were you done? I'd like to bring testifiers down at this point if you are done.
Mr. Chair, I'm done except to probably just again emphasize that we tried to do this about 12 years ago, and this is never going to get done with the, I don't believe, with the bureaucracies in Washington and here in Minnesota working on it. I think we need probably to urge our federal legislators to just do this even up trade, and we can get on with it and start generating some money again for the school trust with 100+ thousand acres of land you know, that should have been producing money.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rucavina, it's good to see you in the committee. I'm looking on page 2, line 2.34 and 2.35, and it talks about all other lands acquired by the state in any manner and under the control of the Commissioner of Natural Resources. And the amendment, the DE1 amendment that we're amending this bill to, also takes authority away from the executive council, the elected executive council of the state, and gives it to the DNR, an appointed commissioner of DNR relating to minerals and leasing and those things. So I want to know your comfort level with giving expanded authority to the commissioner of DNR rather than the executive council.
Comment, Representative Rucavina.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that proposal hasn't passed into law yet. It's just a proposal, and this we were trying to work with staff to use current law on how you who manages these lands currently. You know, Representative Hansen, I've been trying to tell people around here for 26 years that the school kids were getting shortchanged unattended in that. You know, the DNR was not being a very good trustee. How that shakes out is a whole different issue. But this issue here has been around for well over a decade, and the fact of the matter is for over 40 years now, those lands have generated no money for the school trust, and I think the only way to address it is to put something in statute and then talk to our federal legislators.
And Representative Rucavina, just to clarify, you said they have generated no money. I believe they generate hundreds of dollars in the from the permits that the canoers get. Don't they send a few bucks to the state for those permits?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so, but maybe you could ask some of the canoers on the committee.
Thank you,
skied into the Boundary Waters 2 weeks ago, and I didn't pay any money to the school trust, but I think I skied across a couple islands that belong to the kids.
Thank you, Representative Rucavina. We're going to go next to Representative Dill, and I believe Mr. Tuma or someone would like to come down and speak. We can start with them. Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the ability to just speak to the amendment as a whole. If you'll remember my testimony on Tuesday regarding the bill that was before us, I expressed great concern about taking money for the land, or at least for part of the land. And this is to work in a different direction, this amendment. I really am not 100% satisfied with how this lays out, frankly, because I believe the Constitution says that we are to trade lands for equal value. And I'm not sure that at the end of the day, when this is completed, that we will in fact end up with equal value, at least in my eyes. Maybe in the minds of the court, they will feel that we have. So I feel that this is a big movement on the part of myself and Representative Rucavina representing our communities and our legislative districts, and I'm willing to go forward with this. That is the brief reason that the condemnation provisions in the bill, so that eventually, likely, a court will look at it and decide if it meets the Constitution or not.
Thank you, Representative Dill. And Representative Dill, I'm not sure I incorporated your oral amendment into my proposed A1, so I want to do that at this time, and Ms. Taylor has that in writing. Mr. Tuma, to the part of the A1 that's the children's creation of the children's forest, welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is John Tuma. I'm here on behalf of Conservation Minnesota. Also, the Friends of Boundary Waters, I serve on their Policy Committee for them. And I think we're here on behalf of most of the environment conservation groups in the state of Minnesota on this topic. We have been working closely with individuals to try to find a meaningful, workable solution to this for years. This isn't easy. I mean, I've heard some people say, well, if we can get the bridge across to St. Croix, we can do this. Well, it's a big different game here, folks. There's no motivation in D.C. to push this. And by sending this message, what you're doing is essentially going backwards. I spent most of my life negotiating contracts and settlements as an attorney. And what you're doing essentially in the parlays of negotiations with the federal government, who has the upper hand here, is basically saying, I'm poking you in the eye, and what they're going to do is walk away from the table. You're not moving this forward by doing this. This does not make good sense. I know what you need to do, Senator, Representative Dill, and I know what you need to do, Representative Rupavina. I know you need to represent your constituents. I get that. But you're moving backwards. This has been around a long time, Representative Rupavina. I think you wanted to trade property down in Rice County, if I remember, for some of your land up there, or turn my area into a wilderness. I think that's what it is. And so I understand this has been around a while. I understand the need to try to make the statements here at the state capitol. But I can tell you, if this becomes law in the basic common parlays of negotiation, you're just poking them in the eye, and you're going to move backwards. And so we would really advise you not to go in this direction. I know this is difficult. We've been trying to work with you. We've had several people serving on different task force on this. We want to find a solution to this. I don't think this is it.
Thank you, Mr. Tuma. I'd like next to hear from additional folks that are opposed to the inclusion of this idea in the A1. Anyone else want to speak? Any in the audience want to speak against the inclusion of the children's forest language in the A1? Thank you. I would like to ask the DNR, is somebody here from DNR, Lands and Minerals, that could just speak? Director Kramke, I see you coming down. This has not been an initiative that came from you. Just wondering your thoughts on this proposal to try and move this issue forward. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, members. Mr. Chair, this is Larry Kramke. I'm the Director of Lands and Minerals for DNR. And I would say that the amendment does have some elements that would put us backwards. Clearly, we can execute a plan to try to make this a priority in the exchange. We have been working with the Forest Service on trying to identify lands that are suitable to them to conduct this exchange. We have at least a tentative list of lands that are identified right now. You know, to some degree, it'll be a do-over to go back and try to take another look at lands that we may have already covered.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Kramke. Questions for Representative Dill?
Thank you. Hi. I was wondering, maybe we change this to say that whatever your number was, that you can do 48,000 or whatever that number was, but we keep the rest then. And avoid taking money, because I mean, right now I feel like the environmental community is running this, the legislature, the legislative process, and that they are interested in getting money rather than land, so that we can have economic development in the, at least in the north. Now, regarding the school trust lands, the way the bill is, you know, the way the bill is drafted, it would be by and large very good land for the purposes of timbering and mining and possibly leasing for exploration or for other recreational uses. So do you think then if we amended the bill, not that we intend to, not that I intend to, but if we just amended it to say that the 48,000 acres that you have identified, that the working group has identified, that we support trading out 48,000 acres as you've identified, and we just leave the rest in the school trust for the time being and deal with it on another day. I'm not saying that's my solution, but I'm just asking that question and how that would affect the negotiations. I also want to express my thanks for the voluminous number of hours that have been spent negotiating with the Forest Service. But the Forest Service is not the U.S. Congress. It is not the U.S. Senate nor the House of Representatives, and they make the laws, as does the legislature. And working groups and advisory groups and all those things are wonderful, except we're going to decide this at the end. So I think you got my question.
Comment, Director Kramka.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, I think that we've been trying to fulfill the direction that we've been given, which was a two-third, one-third exchange in cash value for the remainder of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area. So the list of lands that we were identifying was trying to hit, I believe the number was about 38,000 acres of exchange land. And, you know, we were negotiating that with the Forest Service in good faith around that one-third land number. If the direction was to go a different route, it might change the negotiations with the Forest Service, but as you indicated, they are not the Congress. So if there was a different policy direction at that level, I'm sure that they would follow that as well.
Questions for Director Kramka? Thank you, Director. Next, is there anybody else who wants to speak for or against this part of the amendment? If you could come down. Thank you. Oh, you're just making room for the Director Kramka. All right. Thank you. Mr. Tammann, welcome to the committee. You could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Tammann from Sedan, Minnesota, old mining town. I worked in several of the mines in my younger days. And as I listen to the debate today, I've heard several times that it's probably not the best policy to trade our land for money. And I think that's a good point for us to consider right now. We're trading our natural resources for money now. We're selling off our taconite, our iron ore. A lot of us going overseas to China. And frankly, the results have not been that impressive. In northern Minnesota, where we have a well-developed taconite mining industry, Representative Rukavina's district actually lost population. And so I'd like to take that argument that it's not wise to sell our land for money to ask us to investigate why we've been selling our ore for money all these years, taking in royalties, taking in taxes, and still every school district on the Iron Range is losing enrollment. We have all this great conversation about how we're doing it for the children. Our children in northern Minnesota, with a well-developed mining industry, are not doing that well. So I think as we go forward with this, perhaps we should take a little time and Google the resource curse. That's the economic theory, that if you try to build an economy on selling off your natural resources, almost inevitably you end up with a lousy economy, and that's what we've got in northern Minnesota. Now, it's great to have all these proposals, which in the end are designed to promote mining, and ask why, after 70 years of the IRRRB being charged with diversifying our economy, our communities are still withering away. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to make note for the record that Mr. Tammann is a constituent of mine from Tower, and we actually are good friends, but we certainly disagree on these issues.
And Representative Dill, if I could clarify, I believe Mr. Tammann lives in Sudan, doesn't he?
That, Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Tammann, for being here again. Anyone else want to speak for or against this part of the amendment? Next, I'd like to go to MnDOT. If MnDOT could come down in regards to the slurry. I thought I saw Mr. Peterson here. Oh, there he is. Okay. If you could speak. And then I don't know if anybody, any other citizens or industry want to also speak to this. This has not been heard in the committee before, unlike the one we just talked about. Representative McFarland had a basis that we built from. This is a bill that just got referred to our committee yesterday. And I believe MPCA has been working with DNR and industry on this issue, on the environmental impact. Members, this would deal with the issue. I don't know if any of you drove on 94. There was a relatively large milling operation project that happened on 94, and it deals with the milling, the dry concrete that they use water to cool the diamond blades, and it's what to do with that slurry of concrete and water. And we're dealing with the how to deal with that and the implications of it. So welcome, Mr. Peterson and Mr. Kudelka. Mr. Peterson, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Peterson. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Department of Transportation. And with respect to the provision regarding diamond grinding slurry disposal, we do have some concerns about the language as it's in the bill. Specifies basically that we should follow industry best management practices, and we are have been in conversation with the diamond grinding industry and identifying you know, a way to identify best management practices that will work in our diamond grinding operations. We like the diamond grinding of our roads. It provides a smoother surface at a reasonable cost, and it's a good way to rehabilitate the surface of our roadways. The sections earlier in the bill, section 70 and section 91, remove some of the barriers that we had seen in the management, in the requirements for management of the waste that previously had MnDOT requiring that the waste be basically disposed of in a landfill, collected and disposed of in a landfill. And so with those two provisions, if they were to remain in changing the way that that waste is regulated, then we're down to identifying best management practices for management of the waste on the construction site. And so we'd like to the opportunity to continue to work with the industry and, identify mutually agreeable ways to move towards those.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peterson. And we had a similar issue a couple days ago. So, again, my office is 375. So if the industry wants to come forward and testify, we are glad to hold this bill over until tonight to get the right language in there so it doesn't leave with the wrong language. So if Mr. Kudelka, do you got comments at this point? Sounds like we need to work and continue to meet today, so when we come back tonight that this issue can be resolved, unless Mr. Peterson, you're telling me that it's just a matter of sometime in the next 49 minutes you can get a solution. That's an opportunity is also there. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, it might take longer than 49 minutes to
thank you.
Some agreement.
Welcome, Mr. Kudelka. If you could identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Kirk Kudelka. I'm the Legislative Director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I would like to just, for the most part, echo the remarks of MnDOT. We have been working together on this along with the industry to find a solution to it. If disposed of improperly, we do have clean water pollution prevention concerns. As DNR mentioned, they had concerns on structural integrity. So we are working with the industry, the three of us, on best management practices that I think will drive the legislative language. Those discussions on best management practices are still ongoing. It's not something I believe will be resolved by tonight or tomorrow's hearing. We're continuing to work on that. At this point, it is correct that there does need to be changes to the solid waste definition to allow for this to be done in a manner that is protective of the environment and also road structure integrity issues.
Thank you, Mr. Kudelka. And to clarify, we'll do it just like the Minnow one. We'll move the amendment the way it is, and if you folks can work with industry to change some of the language, we would be interested in adopting your changes. If we don't get that done, it'll be off to GovOps with the way it is. That's my anticipation on it. Does anyone want to speak? There were some questions to these gentlemen. Representative Hansen, then Representative Purcell. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, how much of the concrete that's in the roads, what's the percentage that are made with fly ash?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I'm afraid I don't have that number available. I can get that for you.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Peterson, is there any bottom ash that's used in concrete in Minnesota?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, again, I'm afraid I'm not that familiar with the composition of, our concrete pavement, but I can certainly get that information for you. I do know that we have used fly ash in our concrete pavement.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kudelka, are there any research reports or analysis on the effect of diamond grinding on fly ash based concrete either for safety measures for the employees that are doing that or the impact of the slurry on the surrounding environment.
Mr. Kudalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, that's something that we're working with MnDOT and the industry to look at the research to develop those best management practices. Those are some of the things we're looking at is what are the components in it to, for the clean water protection.
Representative Hansen.
So, Mr. Chair, I think it's going to be a little hard to come up with a conclusion within the next few hours. There's some very big issues here depending on the source of the concrete and what the components are and what the impact is related to solid waste or other type of waste that we may be dealing with.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question here. I note in Section 64 of the bill of the DE1, I don't mean to refer to it specifically, but I want to mention that because we talk about water quality standards, the state standards and federal standards. Is there a standard, water quality standard, Mr. Kudalka, I guess, that the state would have for water quality for this washout material or for receiving waters? Is there a federal standard for that that you're aware?
Mr. Kudalka, before you... Representative Purcell alluded to washout. Washout actually is a term that has a different connotation. And Mr. Peterson, just to confirm, Representative Purcell, there is specific language in statute about concrete washout. Concrete washout, wet concrete, is treated differently than dry concrete. You referred to it as washout. Are you talking about the millings, the dry concrete that's being milled with water to create a slurry? Representative Purcell.
Mr. Chair, specifically, I'm talking about the receiving waters that this would impact, and is there a federal water quality standard that applies to the receiving waters, the potential pollution that would be received here?
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kudalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there isn't something specifically for concrete, but it falls under the general categories of total suspended solids, concrete, soil, other types of materials that get in the water column, and that's how it's treated, the regulation of it.
Representative Purcell.
And Mr. Kudalka, and the federal government does have a standard on that?
Mr. Kudalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the way that the Clean Water Act is devised, it's the federal government does the framework, the states set individual standards, and then the federal government approves them. In a nutshell, that's how it's done.
Representative Purcell.
Well, Mr. Kudalka and Mr. Chair, the reason I'm asking this is because if you look at Section 64, we are proposing to accept federal standards, and I understand there's a potential amendment to that, but that's the impetus for my question, is if we needed more rigorous standards going forward for total suspended solids, would we be able to do that reasonably?
Comment, Mr. Kudalka.
Mr. Chair and committee members, under the current law, there is the flexibility under the Federal Clean Water Act. The agency has a concern with the provision as it is in the bill right now. It's not something we support, so it's something we would like not to become law.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peterson, could you give us some idea as to the amount of volume this activity produces? Does it just leave the roadway wet, or is there quite an amount of slurry when you utilize this process?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I've never seen this equipment in operation, but what I'm told is that the diamond grinding operation requires a fair amount of water applied where the blades meet the roadbed in order to cool the blades and to control the dust that's created. And that water and concrete particle mix is then vacuumed up and then deposited with a 5-inch hose onto the, what's proposed in here is basically deposited on the in slope. But it's carried off the roadway so it doesn't run across the roadway. But it's relatively large volumes of water is what I'm led to believe.
Mr. Peterson, if I could clarify, you were speaking to the operation of the way it would be if it did not need to be put in a truck and hauled to a landfill.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, that's correct. That's what's proposed in here in the language online. 6.2 is to allow deposit of the concrete slurry along the end slope, so I was just referring to that possible operation.
Thank you. Is there somebody from the industry, did I see, wanted to speak to this issue? If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joe Bagnoli with the law firm of McGrand Shea. I represent the Concrete Paving Association of Minnesota. I'm willing to stand for questions. I don't have too much more to add other than to say I agree. We've been working with MnDOT and PCA on identifying, on trying to figure out this issue. Until 2008, the way that we're proposing to have it deposited on the side of the road was standard operating procedure. In 2008, because we feel we get swept up a little bit in the commercial residential housing construction boom hit, and the EPA in particular started to look at the concrete washout, which is different. Concrete washout is ready-mix trucks where the concrete hasn't hardened, it's wet concrete. And what was going on then was they were, in many cases, the concrete trucks were being washed out and deposited not in an environmentally sensitive or appropriate way into drain gutters or on the side of the road, and that in those cases you have the chemical reaction hasn't fully taken place, and there is magnesium and other chemicals that are in concrete. In the course of regulating that activity, it seemed as if there was the concrete slurry, where when concrete is fully the reaction is fully taken place, it's an inert product. It is considered clean landfill, still is considered clean landfill, and it is equivalent to a rock. In the course of dealing with the concrete washout issue, it seemed, or it was at least very curious, at the exact same time that issue was dealt with, that there was a decision to change how a slurry from concrete diamond grinding was handled, and it was then decided, instead of the way we're proposing to go back to, that it should be all taken up and transported to a landfill. Now, just so we're clear, that in places where there is storm and rainwater gutter, where there is no side slope, we pick it up. And actually, the language that we've proposed indicates that as much. Prohibits discharge into gutters or closed drainage facilities. We also, at the suggestion of the PCA, which we think is a good idea, incorporated in this, the original draft didn't have it, but incorporated it says specifying the concrete slurry must be deposited in a manner that is in compliance with MIN rules part 7050.021. That is the language that protects the state's waters, and we would not put this near state waters.
Thank you, Mr. Bagnoli. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bagnoli. You said in the past it was common practice to deposit this material on the roadside. Were there examples of an incidence where this material caused some water quality issues?
Mr. Bagnoli.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, I am not aware of any. I guess I would look to PCA or MnDOT. I'm not aware of any.
Thank you. Representative Tarkelson. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just kind of follow up on Representative Torkelson's discussion. You know, it seems to me that road building is a particularly expensive endeavor. It's one that is largely a function of government. The changes that federal, it seems, and probably state, obviously state government, have brought to the industry and introduced in the idea of cleaning up the environment, when indeed it appears that there is not a problem, would undoubtedly seem to be a very expensive endeavor. Any idea what this is costing the industry in order to comply with something that appears to be over the top?
Mr. Bagnolia.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jaskowski, we believe that it's added about 40% to our cost. I think and I've had conversations with Mr. Peterson about it, about whether how much it has added. It's undisputed that before we would only suck it up and put it in the trucks when we were around waters, when we were when it would have the potential impact of going into a gutter system or a contained water system. So we did that before. What this has clearly had to have had cost before, we would just, if we were in the rural area, it would just go along the inslope. Now we have to suck it up, and I'm told that the only spot in Minnesota is Monticello, so it's sometimes, if we're in southwestern Minnesota, it is a long tanker ride truck. So it has to have added some cost. I think we would maybe, our folks say it's 40% increase. MnDOT has a little bit different number, and so I'm not sure, but as a general, just intuitive matter, if you weren't doing something before and now you're required to do it, it has to add cost in some way.
Follow-up, Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bagnolia. You know, we're using concrete around buildings in Minnesota. We're using it. If government continues to go out in this way and continue to restrict the ability to do things we've done forever that have not shown a problem to the environment, we're going in the wrong direction. I encourage you two individuals and Mr. Kodelka, as you go forward, please bring us something that's common sense, that will not continue to strap not only industry but the cost of government and taxpayers in what appears to have been a ridiculous encroachment of overregulation. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to, Representative Hansen mentioned one other issue in the A1. It dealt with surveying. I believe it was Section 102, page 7 of the A1 amendment. We're done, gentlemen. Thank you. It dealt with surveying. My understanding is DNR is fine with this. Did you want to ask a question? Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, if they could just state that for the record, so it's in the record. That's
a good idea.
And I also had Section 92 as well.
Okay. Mr. Lockersmo, if you could identify yourself and get on the record in regards to Section 102, and then we'll go to Representative Hansen. Mr. Lockersmo.
Mr. Chairman, Kent Lockersmo with DNR. The Section 102 of the A1 amendment that limits the bonds to $1 million, we are fine with that.
Thank you, Mr. Lockersmo. Representative Hansen, to Section 92, the manure digester permit issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a new provision. I think earlier in committees you had talked about farmers having concerns related to the manure digester, and I'm just wondering, is this for one particular manure digester? I mean, are we doing this for a specific entity, or is this a broader issue?
Is somebody from MPCA want to come down to clarify? If I'm not mistaken, Representative Hansen, there's three operating generators in the state of Minnesota currently, and Deputy Commissioner, you're here, and Deputy Commissioner, you could allude to how many potentially there could be. Welcome, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, David Thornton, I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Pollution Control Agency. We're aware of three of these, and there might be as many as five. Certainly it's a small number. In Wisconsin, there's about 30, but they had a utility provide incentives a while back that made it economically viable. While we would like to see more of these kinds of systems on dairy farms in particular, the economics are such that it's probably not likely that we'll see a flood of these in the near term. As the technology becomes more perfected and such, hopefully they'll catch on and become something that is a desirable component to a dairy farm.
Deputy Commissioner, you're going to need to tell folks, the audience, and folks watching us on TV, what are these generators, where are they at, what are they doing, because I don't think people know what we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, we're talking about some fairly large dairy operations where they take the manure from the lagoons and put them into a closed system that digests the manure and converts it to methane gas that is then burned in an engine to generate electricity. The electricity is generally used on the farm, but there are situations where they can also be hooked up to the grid and sell the power to a utility. Most of these large dairy farms also have what we call emergency generators that they use. These are not powered by the methane from the methane digester, the manure digester. They're generally powered by diesel fuel, and they use those in times when the power actually goes out. There are numerous federal regulations that apply to these types of engines. The permitting process that we've used is generally designed to inform the operators of the requirements that they need to meet in order to comply with the federal regulations. We had a meeting with a number of representatives in the dairy industry a couple of weeks ago, and they expressed their concerns. We've been looking at what we can do to streamline this process. The approach that we were going to suggest is registration permits. There are a couple of changes in rules that need to be made for that to work out. But this approach that's in this amendment can also work. It's just that we want to make sure that the dairy farmers that are pursuing this understand that there are federal regulations that they're expected to comply with and need to be aware of.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I visited one of these manure digesters, and I seem to remember a sign showing tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars of public money that has gone into these through grants, either through the federal government or the state government. And I would think that under a contract to receive federal money or state money, there should be some acknowledgement by the recipient of the subsidy that they need to follow state and federal laws. It wouldn't be something brand new. Can you give us some idea of how subsidized each of these digesters are, and if there's a requirement or arrangements where the local utility has to purchase electricity from them?
Commissioner Tharp.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen, I don't know the answer to either one of those questions. I'm sorry.
Well, if you could get that for us, Deputy Commissioner, in regards to the subsidy, why don't you also include the information on Wisconsin, where it is subsidized by the utilities over there, and they're now have substantially more of these machines than these engines than we do. Representative Hansen, follow up.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you know, there could be a subsidy by the ratepayers. There can be subsidies by the taxpayers. Subsidy and then exemption. Subsidy and exemption. I heard Representative Drazkowski earlier talking about federal government involvement. If the federal government's going to give money, or if the state government's going to give money, I would think that the public would expect that folks follow the laws, and we don't have to go back to statute to exempt them of requirements when we give them subsidies.
Director Thornton, we will work with you to find out the answer to the subsidy when we come back tonight in regards to the three facilities that do operate these. And again, to let folks know, these are engines that are creating renewable energy from cow manure. They are capturing the methane gas instead of letting it go up into the air, and they are running what I call like a diesel engine that is not run by diesel, it's run by cow manure, and I'm using the nice word there, which is a great, great idea, and we're trying to work with these people. They have told us, actually, instead of running the engines, they can just torch the methane gas up into the air, and they don't need any permit. So instead of capturing that gas, creating renewable energy, which many of us in 2007 worked real hard to pass legislation to help that, and now we're telling them they need to spend $60,000 a year to monitor the air from the engines instead of torching it. We don't want them to torch the gas. We like this idea. And then they apply the manure. The manure doesn't even get spread up in the air like our traditional way of watching farmers spread manure, which is the way we would normally see it. They inject it into the ground through a piping system, and it never never has to be in the air. It's really cool technology. And so, Representative Torkelson, you know it a lot better than I. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Thornton, for being here. In general, how long have these generators or engines been in place? When were they installed? And I know they vary from location to location, but in general, has it been for the last year or for a number of years?
Mr. Chairman,
Deputy
Representative Torkelson, I don't know the answer to that with respect to these dairy farm operations, but there are generators all over the state at hospitals, at schools, and in all kinds of situations where people need emergency power if there's a power outage. The difference between these is that the emergency generators generally are run on diesel fuel, and these generators, engines connected to the methane digesters are essentially running on natural gas made from the manure from dairy cows.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe, Mr. Thornton, that at least some of these engines have been in place for a long time. Aren't you aware of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, some of them have been there for a while, yes.
And when they were first installed, did they go through all the necessary permitting requirements to be permitted for operation?
Director Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, no, they didn't, because we didn't know that they were there, and the operators were unaware that there was a need to get a permit.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm a little confused. I believe they did go through the necessary permitting process that they were aware of at the time. You may have discovered some hidden air permits that you were not aware of and they were not aware of and have now been trying to enforce. This seems to be a little out of line. But let's move to another topic. I believe there are a number of these operating in Wisconsin. Are you aware of that?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, yes, we understand there's 30 or so in Wisconsin.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Thornton, which EPA district are Wisconsin and Minnesota located in?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, Region 5, which is located in Chicago.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And are there different rules for different states?
The rules are the same. Mr. Chairman, the rules are the same for all the states. States implement them differently. We've been looking at, since we met, we looked at a number of states. The states with the most generators on dairy farms are places like, as we mentioned, Wisconsin, California, Idaho, New York, Vermont. In the upper Midwest, Wisconsin's the only state that has a significant number of these. We looked at the states around us and how they regulate them. There are different approaches. In Wisconsin, they have a fairly aggressive or rigorous permitting approach. Texas has a three-tiered permitting approach that they use for these facilities. In Iowa, the statute exempts these from having to get a state permit. But again, whether or not they're exempt from the paperwork, there are federal regulations that apply to these facilities, and they would be expected to meet them. There's nothing that we can do with state law or state rules that would change that.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. How long has this difficulty been a problem?
Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question. I do know that one of the farms that we've been talking about has been involved in permitting issues with us for some time, and that's been a source of frustration for them.
Commissioner Torkelson. We're going back and forth to us. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you for the raise, Mr. Chair. I could use the money. Define some time. Is this a matter of a few weeks, a month or so?
Commissioner Thornton.
I don't know specifically, Mr. Chair, but I would say many months would be the answer I would give you.
I would take that to be more than 150 Parkinson. Days. Then.
More than 50 days.
150 days.
More than 150 days, yes, sir.
To clarify, Commissioner Thornton, we've met with you and the commissioner on this for, I believe, two or three times over the last year in an effort to resolve this issue. Part of the basis, if I'm not mistaken, centers around rules put in place that were intended to affect the metropolitan area in regards to air emissions, and unfortunately they're being applied in the rural part of our state, if I'm not mistaken, and that's some of the challenge as we go forward trying to deal with this issue. Isn't that part of the history of this issue?
Well, Mr. Chairman, not exactly, but close. We obviously are much more concerned about...
Commissioner Thornton, that doesn't surprise anybody in the room that I didn't get it right, but I was close. Commissioner Thornton.
Mr. Chairman, we are much more concerned about the emissions from these kinds of facilities in the metropolitan area and in areas where there are significant numbers of people, because the concentration of emission sources just results in a situation where the air quality isn't as clean. I think for the most part, especially in a farm situation like this, the likelihood of there being an air quality problem associated with the engines, these engines and the way that they are being used is very low. We think that there are ways to streamline the process. We have been looking at the possibility of registration permits that could be used. That's a fairly simple permitting process where the applicant doesn't really need to hire anyone with particular expertise. It's just mainly supplying us with some information, and then we give them a document that clearly outlines the regulations that they need to follow. And again, in this case, these are federal regulations. The approach that's taken in this amendment takes away the paperwork, but it doesn't eliminate the fact that these operators of these engines still need to meet certain federal requirements, and in particular, the one that is of concern is that they need to do some testing. And we talked about that when we met. It's our opinion that this testing that's being required is a little bit onerous, and we will continue to work with the industry and EPA to try to make sure that they can scale this back into such a way that it's more reasonable for everybody.
Well, thank you, Deputy Commissioner, and I think you actually summed up just right there the gist of this issue. And the gist of the push for Representative Fabian's House File 1 and the governor's executive orders, that we're trying to streamline and do common sense things, and that you and I both really like, and Representative Torkelson and a lot of other people really like the idea of generating this renewable energy out on the farm, and we want to do the common sense thing. I understand someone may be using my office currently to talk about a previous issue, but Representative Torkelson's office is very close by in 371, and that would be available for you and the industry if you need to work a little farther on this language. Sounds like you've got a little different idea. After we adopt this amendment, if you've got some changes you'd like to see, you or Mr. Kadelka could come back tonight after a discussion, and you've got some additional information you were going to capture that Representative Hansen asked about. If that would be great, if you'd be able to do that. I've got Representative Wagenius and then Representative Drazkowski. Representative Wagenius.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This feels like we are moving to a vote, and I'd ask for a roll call.
On the amendment?
On the A1 amendment.
Okay, thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, thank you as author of the amendment for including this language in your members. I hope the people that are watching on TV are seeing what we are discovering here in the last 15 minutes. Again, the second item that's come forward that shows that collectively our federal and state government are pushing forward regulations that violate not only the rules of common sense but the rules of economics and others. Mr. Thornton?
Commissioner Thornton.
Commissioner Thornton. What happens on the other, I think it's 5,000 dairy farms we have in Minnesota that don't run their manure through this digester and then burn it or burn it through an engine? What happens with the methane, the nitrogen, and the other elements of that manure on those farms? Where does it go?
Well, Mr.
Commissioner Thornton,
Representative Drazkowski, a lot of it gets emitted right into the air, right from the lagoon, or from when the manure is spread on the land. That's why there's a benefit we see in moving towards this kind of technology.
Follow-up, Representative Drazkowski.
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Thornton, thank you for that answer, and that's been my observation being on hundreds of farms myself. And farms have been doing this long before any of us were here. Cattle, and by the way, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for using the nice word earlier that you talked about. I think cows are nice, too.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski.
But that was supposed to be funny, members. I guess I failed.
Clerk will call the roll to the A1.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski.
I have an oral amendment, if we could, before.
Representative Drazkowski, your oral amendment.
And it is to the same section. Line 6.10, Mr. Chair, I'd like to strike the comma.
Clarify, Representative Drazkowski, you're not on the manure digester issue. It's near it, but it's a different issue.
Correct.
Representative Drazkowski, to your oral amendment.
Line 6.10 to strike the comma and insert an or so it reads better, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Taylor, if you could speak to representatives, clarify what Representative Drazkowski is doing.
Mr. Chair, members, it'd be on line 6.10 after proposed the comma, delete that comma and insert or.
And Representative Drazkowski, the effect of your amendment.
The effect, Mr. Chair, is to make it more clear that they would have the option of either printing in the newspaper or posting it on a website. It reads better this way. That was the intent, as I understand, of the language when it was presented, but this makes it clear, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and I'll incorporate that oral amendment in my amendment. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, on further thought, if you look on line 6.13, there's an or there. There's actually another option that's in current statute, so I think they want to keep it as it is, and then there'll be three options rather than the two.
Representative Drazkowski, I think what Ms. Taylor is saying, what you want to have happen already can happen. Would that be the gist of what?
Yep, Mr. Chair, yeah, that's correct.
Will you withdraw your oral amendment, Representative Drazkowski?
I will, but I want to be clear first, Mr. Chair. It seems that the way it is written now, maybe Ms. Taylor can help me understand better, but the way it's written now, it appears that the option is to post in the newspaper while simultaneously posting it on a website or the other language that is in the bill itself.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, well, currently there's the option in the manner approved by the EQB, which is currently in the EQB monitor, and that. So if you're adding two additional, so the or on 6.13 would, we're just listing one, two, or three. So kind of simplify, you're allowing the newspaper, the website, or the manner that's in current law.
Representative Drazkowski, let's assume any one of the three options is an option, and if we find out different, we'll deal with it tonight.
I will withdraw my amendment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Clerk will call the roll. McNamara?
Yes.
Anderson? Beard?
Aye.
Dill?
Yes.
Drazkowski?
Yes.
Fabian? Falk?
No.
Hackbarth?
Aye.
Hancock?
Aye.
Hansen?
No.
Hilty?
No.
Knuth?
No.
Purcell?
No.
Quam?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Torkelson?
Aye.
Wagenius?
No.
There being 9 ayes and 6 nays, the amendment is adopted to the DE1. I want to give folks, some folks I understand are not going to be able to come back tonight and are here. Mr. Larson, I believe you had some comments about environmental review and you're not able to come back tonight. Is that true? Did you want to speak to a couple of issues? Specifically, Mr. Larson, I'd like you to speak to Section 98. I believe Section 98 is us building on House File 1, the governor's executive order, and modernizing environmental review. I think this would allow us to move forward. And if you could identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and your comments on that, my understanding is you may possibly not be able to be here tonight. Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Larson. I'm from Larkin Hoffman Law Firm. I was asked some questions by some members on this provision, so I'm not here for a client, but I was asked to just come in and make some comments on it. I was asked questions and helped draft some issues in here. And could you direct me to a page number? I was, it's
page 65.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was just asked to talk a little bit about the mandatory categories that are in here. This provision would provide for compilation and review of some information on mandatory categories that are currently in rules. And the history that I was asked to provide is that most of these mandatory categories were created in 1982. In 1980, the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act was changed significantly. It really was made to look like it does today. There were some significant changes. In 1980, the legislature asked the EQB to identify projects that were required to do an EAW, required to do an EIS, or perhaps exempt from environmental review. And what you see in law today, or in the rules today, is what was created in 1982 after the legislature asked in 1980 for that to be done. An example that I have of why these maybe should be looked at, and I certainly wouldn't suggest that lots of them should be eliminated. This is really an information gathering process. We had a school up north that was designed as a 98,000 square foot school. Because of community meetings, it changed into a 106,000 square foot school. Because it was in a rural area, it required an EAW. If it had been in a city, it wouldn't have. And so that small change, which kind of snuck up on the proposers, required them to do an EAW. It probably cost them 3 or 4 months. So that's just an example. These, again, most of these mandatory categories were created in 1982, 30 years ago. And what this information, what this would do would be require some information gathering for you.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The governor is already working on this. So what is it in here that goes beyond what the governor has already been working on under an executive order?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I don't know that there's anything here that's beyond it. I was just asked to provide some advice on some language that would be specific to those categories to ask for some information as part of that activity. So I'm not aware, I'm not familiar with what their plan is, but it is intended to be, as it's written, to be part of that governor's request to the EQB to do this work.
Representative Wagenius.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm not understanding why this is being put in statute if the governor's already working on this. That's.
Thank you. Representative Quam. No, Representative Fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Larson, if you could go to Section 66. I know we talked once before about this. This is the whole controversy with regards to over-enforcement for the sake of padding the department's budget. I mean, that's it seems like that's kind of a common theme that's often brought up. But I know that you talked about that a little bit before, but I was wondering if in the time that's passed, if you've had a chance to rack your memory anymore, if you could list any instances when you worked at the department or from any commissioners thereafter that have overzealously enforced actions to pad their own budget. Is there any evidence of that?
Mr. Larson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, I thought about that after I was here before on that a different provision, and I have the same answer. If I'm sitting across the table from an agency staff person and they're calculating a penalty, I don't think they're sitting there trying to figure out how to make money to pay for agency programs. But I will tell you without question that there are people out there who know that change took place and believe that fines are being assessed to do that. And I'm not telling you that because it's my opinion. I'm telling you that because that is a clear statement I've heard many times from people in enforcement actions.
Thank you. Representative Fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that, Mr. Larson. I guess it kind of harkens back to the old saying that I can only tell you the truth, I can't force you to believe it, and that when you're dealing with certain individuals. So I just appreciate once again hearing that really there's no evidence to suggest that overly zealous enforcement action is leading to padding or enhancing agency budgets.
Time out, Mr. Larson. Folks that are standing in the door, you need to close the door. We're in a committee hearing here. You can't have the door open. You're here for the next committee. It doesn't start until 10:15. Sergeant-at-Arms will keep people out of the room from going in and out. Representative Falk, I'm going to ask you to repeat your comment again. Sorry for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I was just thanking Mr. Larson for his comments, and the comment I made is with respect to people who feel that the agency is padding its budget through enforcement actions. Sometimes you can only tell a person the truth. You can't force them to believe it, and I think that's clearly the case here. So I do think that this is reinforcing a stereotype that doesn't exist, this section that's put in the bill.
Thank you. Additional comments? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was following up on Representative Wagenius's on Section 98, which I think Mr. Larson was here for. And I don't know if there's anybody here from the EQB. And even if there is a directive to be looking at some of these things, I know there's a cost to them. So do we know what the cost of Section 98 is, and would that result in a fiscal note being needed?
Representative Hansen, we have asked for a fiscal note, and we have not got it yet. So it's a good a point well made. Members, I wanted to make one more point. In our packet was an A2 amendment. I don't believe that's intended to be brought forward. In the efforts to make sure that everyone got these amendments posted and such, I believe that amendment won't be offered unless one of the members here leads me to believe differently. So, members, with that, Representative Hansen, I'm going to we're going to wrap up here just a couple minutes early and go through program questions and to allow the huge audience that's outside to get in the room in time. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that I'm just to be clear when we come back tonight, the A2, that's the privatizing of public waters amendment that was in our packet?
Correct. Representative Hansen, what I was trying to do there was let folks know that may be here just for the A2. I don't believe that was something that I wanted to let folks know. It's not something I support, and I do not intend for anybody to bring that up unless someone here is going to tell me that it's being brought up, and it was my understanding that was not supposed to be here. In our efforts to clarify and make sure that we're trying to be transparent and give people the proper notice so they can be here, I wanted to let folks know because I know at least, if I'm not mistaken, DNR had asked about that, and unfortunately it got in that I didn't know it meant to get in. Let's see. I've got Representative Purcell.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair, will PCA be back tonight? I've got some questions that are going to – I would appreciate that.
Representative Purcell, PCA, DNR, Bowser, and a lot of other folks better all be back here tonight, but that's a great point. Anybody that has an interest in this bill, as Representative Hansen has alluded to, this is a big bill, got lots of moving parts. We did a lot of informational hearings going into this with the idea that we were trying to be transparent, be nimble, and adapt to changes, but we absolutely want to be transparent and allow the public. Is there any other member of the public here? We still have a few more minutes that will not be able to come back tonight and wanted to speak for or against the bill in its current form. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill that will not be able to come back at 6 o'clock tonight? Members, we need to keep all this information in your packet so you will have it tonight. We have only adopted the A1 amendment to get the DE in the shape I, as the author, would like, and so we've got a lot of work before us tonight yet. Representative Jaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back to Representative Hansen's comment on Section 98 and what the fiscal impact might be, I would also ask that any fiscal information we get back might also include the number of reports that we are actually getting rid of in this bill and the fiscal offsetting impact that that may have as well. Thank you.
To that point, Representative Jaskowski, Mr. Reynolds, if you could just give us a one-minute synopsis of what would be included in a fiscal note that would come forward.
Mr. Chairman, fiscal notes are when they are requested to the agencies, their response should include all items in the bill that they feel have fiscal effects.
Mr. Reynolds, that would be savings and expenses.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Members, we're in recess till 6 tonight. Thanks for being patient, members. Sorry for that delay. Let's reconvene the Environment, Energy, Natural Resources. In regards to the concrete slurry deal, MnDOT, MPCA, and the industry are still working on that. So at this point, they would prefer we just leave the language in here and know that in the end, they may not have consensus, but they are actually much closer than they were, but they wanted to make sure that it was known that there is not consensus at this point. Does any members have questions for any of those testifiers in regards to that issue, or I believe they're ready to go? If you could come to the table, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my question was more to you, maybe to them as well, is we've had a few times here now where agency folks in the executive branch have been directed to go meet with lobbyists off in another room, maybe not with any public or openness. And so I'm just wondering, when these communications go on between the agency being told to cooperate and the lobbying community representing interests, if those are just one interest, or is this an open process where any member of the public can come and watch this now or communicate, or is it just the industry and the agencies?
To that point, Representative Hansen, my office door does not would not be locked, and it would be open, and I certainly hope any discussion going on there would have the door open and anybody from the public would be welcome to go on. And I'm not sure what these folks have discussed, but if they've come closer to a conclusion, it certainly would be discussed here or in whatever committee that would be. So I don't know, Mr. Peterson or Mr. Bagnoli or Mr. Kredelka, if you want to add something, that if you've made some headway from where we were at this morning in your discussions, that we would appreciate an update. Mr. Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Scott Peterson, the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Yeah, we've been in conversations with Mr. Kredelka and Mr. Bagnoli for several weeks now, actually, on this topic, and we really are down to assuming that the assuming that the classification of the slurry is changed so that it doesn't have to be treated as solid waste, that we're down to identifying some best management practices. And in our conversations, it seems like there are some or several potential mutually agreeable ways at which we can do it, depending upon the location in which the project is located. And so I think in this whole process, actually, the public is being well-served in trying to figure this out.
Representative Hansen. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen, and we look forward to you continuing to work on that issue. Well, you know what, members, why don't we go through a couple of the issues. There is some language on the Executive Council and how on mineral on the minerals issue. Is there any member? Do any members have any questions in regards to that issue? Would they like anyone to speak to that? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I asked her this morning, where did that language come from, where the elected officials are removed in favor of the appointed Commissioner of DNR making the decision? So just, where was the source of that language?
Representative Hansen, I would say I was one that was hopeful that we could find some solution to this. There's been some folks that have asked that folks in northeastern Minnesota be given back their mineral rights that they don't currently own, and that we would somehow do that. And I was one that said, if we're going to give people in northeastern Minnesota their mineral rights back, we're going to have to go to southwestern Minnesota and begin to offer farmers the right to give their permanent easements back on agricultural land. And I do not want that to happen. I don't think that's right. I know some members in this on this committee believe that permanent easement shouldn't necessarily be permanent, but I don't think that's right. And so I asked for a solution, and this is the solution that we've come up with, and we're certainly open to thoughts of changing it if you have ideas. Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't say anything about permanent easements. I was asking about the Executive Council, and the Executive Council is made up of the statewide elected officials. So if you're the author of that, I now understand that that's where it came from, but that's a different question than whether or not we have permanent easements or the solution for mineral rights. It's taking the Executive Council out of the decision-making loop and giving it solely to the DNR commissioner, who is appointed rather than elected by the voters of the state as a whole.
Point well made. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm extraordinarily concerned about this particular provision. There is no other remedy for citizens other than to go to the Executive Council. And I have noticed, I mean, the same thing with the minor permits, that a lot of what is happening here is taking away rights of citizens actually to protect their own properties. And I can't say that I'm surprised that that is what we're doing, but or what you're proposing to do, because I can't support this. But when people have property rights, like in the minor permit dispute, for those property rights to be taken away automatically almost seems to rise to a constitutional issue where somebody's property rights are taken without due process. That's on a kind of a theoretical level, but on a practical level, I don't know how you classify a minor permit, but if somebody wants to get a permit next door to me and they're on same aquifer I am, I want to know if I'm going to have enough water in 2 years or in 5 years. I don't want to have to drill a new well. So I do see that both of these issues are property rights issues, and I'm dismayed that they're in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Knute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question was similar to Representative Hansen's. I just want to know the history of why this is here and what's here, because I think it is a really big change, taking the rights to bring concerns before the Executive Council with this, which are pretty important issues, especially for people's personal property and property rights. So I'd just be interested in some testimony about where this came from and what the implications are. I think we should learn a little bit more about this before voting on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Canoe.
Mr. Chair, is there anyone who's going to be testifying on this? Or
we could bring the DNR down. Does anybody from DNR want to testify? Representative Canute, did you want to rephrase it in a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to know the reasoning behind it and what the agency, how the agency thinks it'll affect it, and what the agency's view of it is. Because I think it is a pretty significant change that we haven't really discussed.
Director Kramka, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Larry Kramka, DNR Lands and Minerals Director. Excuse me, I'm catching my breath there a second because I rushed in. Executive Council oversees currently the approval of mineral leases and several other leases related to peat, and there's also a large forestry lease that requires currently Executive Council approval. Those Executive Council approvals came into place back at an earlier time in our state's history when There was concern over, concern over the amount of money that was potentially involved in these leases at a time when there was a history of maybe not so good dealings on forestry matters, actually, in the early part of the century. The thought was that there needed to be some oversight to make sure that those kinds of special deals didn't happen, and that the state got the appropriate amount of you know, revenues into the various trust funds. Since that time, the state's obviously become a much more mature agency structure. There's a lot more regulations in play. Most of the leases that we're talking about here are done through various kinds of public sales, whether they be public auctions or some type of a bid format, bringing quite a bit of transparency into the sale process. In addition to that, clearly there's an awful lot more accounting sophistication within state government now than there was at the early 1900s.
So Director Kramke, I assumed you were talking about the 21st century. Which century are you talking about?
Actually, this would be the early 1900s.
So this is
wrong century.
Okay. Director Kramke, additional comment?
Like I said, I was catching my breath that was coming in here. Sorry about that. Periodically throughout time, there has been an issue related to some mineral leases that have come before the Executive Council, where there's been a pause in the issuance of leases basically related to non-ferrous mining. And again, in the last year, we saw that happen where a mineral lease sale that we had gone through the normal process of public sale notice and you know, the bid process, and getting to the point of awarding bids, where the Executive Council basically said they were not in a position where they wanted to approve those leases. There was no indication at that time of anything that was wrong within the process that was used. There was nothing wrong in the public sale itself, and there wasn't any implications that procedurally or you know, from a corruption standpoint, that anything had gone on like a sweetheart deal behind the scenes. The only thing that really was talked about was the concern about surface owners who own land but don't own the mineral rights below them. And in these cases, these were mineral rights that were owned by the state. So the state is an asset holder of a mineral right. The trust funds you know, have the trustee obligation on our part to try to use those mineral royalties and mineral rights to try to bring revenues into the state's coffers. So the language that you see in front of us was not agency bill. This wasn't our proposal, but the governor's office and several of the executive council members did testify at the last executive council meeting where these leases were tabled, that a couple of the things that they wanted us to look at over a six-month period of time was whether or not the role of the executive council was clearly articulated in law, whether there needed to be some additional guidelines on what went into their decision making, and also give the legislature an opportunity to think about alternatives or looking at the severed mineral issue that was before them at that time. We have met with the executive council members to talk about some of these issues, and I'm certainly not going to speak for all of them. They have varied opinions on what the right answer is, and this language clearly is one of the things that was talked about as a possibility from the executive council of whether or not they should be in the position of approving leases anymore.
Thank you. Representative Canute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Kramke, I think, covered it a little bit, but you know, this is just getting rid of the power. And it's not, I guess that's one sort of clarification, but it's not necessarily I mean, it sounds like there's not agreement within the Executive Council, and this is an agency language, and you're working through a process, it sounds like, to kind of be more clear about this, but that process is ongoing, or do you think that process is complete? I'm just kind of curious about, I mean, there's not an official process, but obviously they directed you to look into it, and you've been discussing it, and, you know, just getting rid of the power is one way to do it, but there's other ways to be more clear about it as well, I would think.
Director Kramka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knuth, I think that you're right in that there isn't a process that's been clearly articulated going forward. We were asked to look at a lot of different questions. Some of them were not necessarily in alignment with each other. They were 180 degrees out of phase, like taking away the executive committee's approval process, as well as looking at more clear rules. What I can tell you is that the vast majority of the leases that the agency does now do not require executive council approval. One of the other things that they had asked us to look at is things like the rental rates and the royalty rates, and we've been doing that as well to determine whether or not we're in line with the rest of the state on those things. The agency currently has the authority to set rental rates, for instance, on most of the other leases that we issue, except for the ones that are listed here in the bill. So there is process that's already in place for a lot of the other leases that we routinely do in the agency.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Director. I got a technical question, not about the exec council, but more about the leases themselves. Is it often that when you look at a lease for mining under the surface, that you find on the Torrens title or the abstract of a property owner on the surface that it's not noted very plainly on the deed that the surface rights are severed to somebody's like James J. Hill or the Bennett family or Pillsbury's or the state of Minnesota? I mean, I looked at my deeds when this started to come up for the properties that I own in Minnesota, and it just like very plainly says that the mineral rights are severed. Is it common that that isn't clear on these documents?
Director Kramka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, it is certainly much more common in areas where there's active mineral exploration or active mineral activity from the past. Many of the abstracts that are done have clarification on them that they are not actually speaking to the mineral rights or flow easements. It's one of the qualifiers that abstract attorneys typically put on the cover page. But even on my own abstract, I know that I can go back in and see where the minerals were reserved by other parties, and so they aren't mine.
Representative Dill.
So, not ever handling these purchases myself, but through a lawyer, would it be common that they would advise a client that there is about the mineral rights? Do you have knowledge of that, that those mineral rights belong to the surface owner or that they belong to someone else?
Director Kramka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, it would be both common in areas where mineral interests are fairly active or had been active in the past to have that conversation. You may not have that same thing happen in, for instance, southwest Minnesota, where that's not an active part of the land management down there.
So one
Representative Dill.
Well, so in other words, in St. Louis, Lake, and Cook, and Itasca, and those counties where this is going on, I mean, people are generally aware that they don't have the mineral rights as a rule.
Director Kramka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, I would certainly not speak to every case. There are those cases where that might not occur just because the abstractor may not have actually done that work. But in general, the general rule would be yes, they would know.
Additional questions on this issue? Representative Wagenius.
Well, I think we're kind of moving away from the fundamental issue here. And that is, should this power be taken away from the executive? Do you know the governor's position on this? Do you know the Secretary of State's position? the auditor's position.
Director Kramka.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, we don't speak for any of those people. We've had conversations about the various questions that they asked us to look at, this being one of them. Each of them has various, I would say, nuances to what they think is appropriate or not in this regard, and I'm certainly not going to speak for any of them.
Well, Director Kramka, I would hope that as this goes forward, they would have an opportunity to weigh in, and they certainly are part of the administration. So through the legislators here and through the administration, they can weigh in. And if the administration and all the executive council members are against it, we're not going to be able to do this because we can't pass the law unless the governor signs it. I don't think we're going to have the votes to override, so we'd rather work with the administration. Representative Wagenius.
Well,
additional questions on this point? Thank you, Director Kramka. One other one, we had asked, we have in this bill a parks report. I'm not sure which section that is. That's something that... Section 96, Legislative Report on State Parks, Recreation Areas, Trails, State Forests, just to come back, ask the agency to come back on the feasibility of operating the state park system. I don't know if anybody had any questions on that issue. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I did have a question because online, if I'm looking at the right section, 64th, page 64, is that what you're talking about, in section 96?
Correct.
On 6430, it says, to ensure investment focuses on Minnesota's most important natural resources and highest quality recreational opportunities. What are the most important natural resources?
I would say that would be subject to opinion, Representative Wagenius.
Pardon?
Representative Wagenius. I think it would be somewhat subject to opinion. Representative Wagenius.
Well, yeah, that's what I think too, Mr. Chairman. And so I don't know what we get out of this because it's going to be very subjective. And if we really want good information, I think we need to set out criteria that we really want to hear back on. So I worry about that language.
Representative Wagenius, I would encourage you, if you've got some ideas for us to bring forward some criteria that as the bill goes forward in other committees or on the floor, I think we're certainly open to that idea. We're very serious about this report and asking the DNR to come forward with ideas they have. So if you've got some thoughts on how we can help them move forward, that would be appreciated. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you then. Mr. Chairman, help me understand, because I can't do it reading this. Why are you doing the report? I mean, what do you want the outcome to be of the report?
Representative Wagenius, I don't have a predetermined outcome. If I knew what I was looking for, I probably wouldn't be asking. I wouldn't be part of the folks that think it would be good to get a report. Representative Wagenius.
Well, I don't know what we're going to get out of this because it's so generally defined, and I have not had good luck with getting reports that are specific with very general language. Just that's my, you know, having asked for reports before, if you don't ask for very specific things, you get pretty general language and it's not very meaningful.
Is anyone here from DNR Parks and Trails? If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Potter with the Division of Parks and Trails, DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Potter. And Representative Wagenius, a specific question?
Well, Let me pose it in a different way. Are you looking for possibilities which parks to close because they don't have the most important natural resources and the highest quality recreational opportunities?
Well, Representative Wagenius, I think this report could come back and DNR could conceivably say there's a park that could be repurposed as opposed to saying closed. I mean, I guess they could recommend one be closed, but when you say close a state park, I would more apt to call it a repurpose because it probably will become something else. Would that potentially be a county park, a state rec area, a private operation, private park run by private enterprise and potentially leased out to them, sold to them? I think all of those things conceivably by looking at this could be possibilities. Maybe Mr. Potter could at this point explain what his thoughts are, what some different options they may look at. Mr. Potter.
Mr. Chairman, members, this is not in the governor's bill, of course, but what we would see this as meaning would be parks, for example, gets a third of our budget or so from the general fund. We know the general fund is continuing to go down. One of the things this study could do is help us look at other funding sources to maybe replace some of that, so we weren't quite so dependent on general fund. Looking at the facilities, the right-sizing issue would be, you know, we may have some state parks that would function better as state rec areas. We may have some state rec areas that should be state parks. We may have some forest campgrounds that maybe should be a state park. Looking at all of our recreational facilities and seeing if they're in the right part of the 86A, the outdoor rec, and if we should have things maybe differently. The same with state trails. Maybe some of our state trails should be regional trails.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for what you're saying they're different things, but from what our testifier is saying, you could do all those things right now. You do not need a legislative report. You could make these determinations and present them to the legislature if you thought they were necessary. Am I correct about that?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Potter.
Representative Wagenius, yes, we could do that. But I think we would prefer that it was a little broader than maybe just us making these calls.
No, I didn't mean
Representative Wagenius.
I didn't mean making the calls and making the decision, but you could right now, without legislative action, make recommendations to us about things that should be reconsidered or considered in the future. Yes?
Mr. Potter.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius, just to clarify, they certainly could. We wanted them to do it. We wanted to be known that we would like to be able to come back next year in a budget year and have some more information for this body as we look at what are different things that we could be doing and making sure they're evaluating their different options. So the idea was we would like this information, and so that's we wanted to push that issue forward and move it forward, I should say. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question on that, Section 96, was similar. I know that Representative Drazkowski has raised the issue a number of times about privatizing parks or selling them off and that, so I think we heard that could be included in this section. I want to go to the one right above it, Mr. Chair, Section 95. And because I don't believe we heard this during the committee, and I know a week or two ago we had the resort community come in, and they were complaining to me about we bought Lake LaSalle and had a resort on it, and then the DNR still has the resort in competition with the resort, So I'm a little confused about what happened there, and maybe if we could get some clarification, because I know I'm sure other members were getting that question on the LaSalle Lake issue. So did we buy the campground and then take it over or contract with the prior camper, or what happened with LaSalle Lake?
Mr. Potter, just I wanted to clarify, to Representative Hansen's point, we just got the report, maybe today, if I'm not mistaken, the report that was due us, I believe it was due March 1st, and might have been due March 1st, Representative Hansen. I met with DNR in late February, reviewed some things, and asked them if they would take a few more days to come back to us, and the report, I believe, came today on Lake LaSalle, and I'm not positive, but we'll have staff check right now, so we'll get that report to everybody ASAP. And then, Mr. Potter, I believe Section 95, if I remember right, Ms. Taylor said that was a DNR initiative. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this or what this is about, the hunt, the dogs in the hunting season. And if you don't know, whoever is appropriate at DNR could get back to us on the rationale of this. I was trying to follow it too, Representative Hansen. I'm not sure what they're getting at here. Do you happen to know, Mr. Potter?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding of this is that it's a state rec area. It was purchased with a lot of the Lassard Sam's funding, and therefore we want to be able to have hunting seasons in there, and that means that there would be dogs that would be off leashes as they were hunting, and I believe that's what this is getting at.
So, Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I finally have my off-leash dog park, then, I think.
I missed it. Representative Hansen.
I finally have my off-leash dog park, then.
You have a huge off-leash dog park, actually, here. But they need to be under control. Yes, but I think they got to be under control at an off-leash park also. Additional questions?
Sure, I'll be looking forward to how the votes go on this one.
Okay. Thank you. Next, Representative Torkelson, is yours the A3 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A3 amendment. It affects page 53, I believe, of the bill. This adds biobutanol language. We've added biobutanol language in other locations, and this was really just an oversight, I believe.
Questions to the A3. All those in favor say aye. Oops, sorry. Representative Wagenius, I didn't see it. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the fairness issue that you're trying to get at here, but one of the big issues we have with facilities is they are choosing sites on spur railroads and not thinking about what water capacity is available. And it seems to me that we should figure out some way, if we're going to exempt these folks, for some way for them to have looked at water availability before they get too locked into a proposal that is really hard to justify. So one of the problems we have in all of this permitting is people going down one road and going, whoops, this isn't going to work. We've got to redo what we were doing. And I'm worried about the whoops potential here because we're looking at, you know, siting a facility and avoiding an environmental review, and then, oh, my gosh, we've got a water problem here. So exempting things doesn't always make the best sense. I would think something as an alternative would be better.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These additional facilities are really upgrading an existing facility that's already been permitted and has had its water issues examined during the original permitting process. I am not familiar enough with the biobutanol process to know if it takes more water than ethanol. I just don't know. I know the product is
is more useful in many ways and is actually of a different chemical nature so that it can be run through pipelines, so there may be some advantages for transportation issues. But as far as water goes, I would have to have more information before I could really answer your concern.
Representative Wagenius.
I think that, I mean, that is the issue. I don't know whether these plants take more water or less. That's probably a good reason not to do these kinds of things without asking PCA if there might be a better way to get at the issue you want.
Additional comments on the A3? Oh, Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess the question I have is, I believe we have one biobutanol facility in the state. Is that correct?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think any are up and operating. I believe we have two that are in the process of being constructed. They're additions to existing ethanol plants.
Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that, Representative Torkelson. Are those cooperatives, or what is the ownership structure?
I, Mr. Chair, I do not know.
Okay. Thank you for that. I guess this, I remember when we had some debate about the type of facilities we would allow to expand up to a certain level last year, and part of, I think, the need is to protect some of our cooperative farmer-owned ethanol facilities, and I want to make sure that as we're looking at this, that we don't want to have just the largest entities coming in providing undue competition for the strong ethanol industry that we have in the state. I know they've had some tough years, and so I'm just a little bit nervous about if this is going to open up the floodgates, so to speak, for some unforeseen consequences with dealing with biobutanol with when we have our farmer-owned ethanol-based facilities right now. Do we have any issues there?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure you were also in Ag Committee this morning when we saw some information on biobutanol production, and it's my understanding that this is a new product that can be produced from a variety of natural sources and would actually probably reduce the amount of ethanol produced in the state, which should make the competitive environment for ethanol actually more beneficial rather than less beneficial.
Well, Representative Paul. Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, that's part of my concern is because if we're going to have a number of these plants showing up that are not cooperative-based, farmer-owned, and so you've got, you know, some major entity coming in and basically taking the market away from that industry that we've built and we've really worked to hold up in rural parts of the state, I see that as being potentially a problem. And I don't know if we want to go down this path right now till we know more. If that's going to be one of the things where this is taking the bottom out of the ethanol industry, that makes me very nervous, and I think anybody from a rural part of the state would be nervous about that.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are not new plants, Representative Falk. These are existing ethanol plants that are being converted to produce biobutanol.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But under this exemption, would a new plant be allowed to be constructed and permitted, and that wouldn't have to be cooperatively owned? Because if I'm understanding this, they're not having to go through the EIS process the same, and so I'm just trying to understand that.
Representative Torkelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, this does not relate to new plants. This relates to existing plants that are being converted to produce biobutanol.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the clarification, and I hope that is the case, that this is only to the benefit of our cooperative ethanol plants and not to the detriment.
Representative Wagenius, to this point.
To this point, I guess I'm reading the language differently than Representative Torkelson is, and I would ask counsel to clarify if a new plant could be cited with this language.
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, the way I read this particular part of the legislation, it would allow for the a new plant to be exempt from the requirements.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. And just a comment on the water issue that was brought up in terms of these butanol plants. And again, we heard from them this morning in the Ag Committee. And I don't know if this is true, but they talked about that the butanol production would be about 30% less in volume, but have more power when they finish the process. So I would assume from that they would take less water if they are producing 30% less volume in their process.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anderson, I'm glad they would be taking less water. The question is, are we encouraging people to site where there is water? For example, would you maybe say you can use this municipality's wastewater treatment water and get a benefit from it? Or a place on the Mississippi where there is abundant water? It's the question is looking at that issue beforehand. It's not saying no. it's saying what do we have that helps folks pick a good site rather than having picked a site, now having to screw it around and try to make it work. And I think that's where we get a lot of problems in our permits, because the site just turns out to be not the greatest, where if we thought that through or helped somebody think it through, and they could say, I mean, I always like to use the example, there's a plant, an ethanol plant out of Fargo, that uses the water from the Fargo Municipal Wastewater Treatment Plant. They pipe that water 19 miles, but it seems to be beneficial for them. We need to have some system that allows us to encourage people to look at that issue. That's all I think I'm getting at.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to withdraw this amendment because I am not completely comfortable with the impact, and I have questions that cannot be answered right now.
Representative Beard, were you to the A3?
Yeah, I was going to ask if moratoriums applied to his amendment, but since he's withdrawing, I'll ask it another time.
Okay, thank you. I have Ms. Daub would like to speak to the bill, I believe, at one specific point. Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you. My name is Betsy Daub. I am the policy director with Friends of the Boundary Waters Wilderness. Thank you for giving me this chance to speak, Mr. Chair and members. I'd like to speak in particular to a component in the A1 amendment about school trust lands, if I could. The environmental and conservation community would like to very much to see this issue of the school trust lands in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness be resolved. And to that end, I participated for a year in a working group that was established by the Permanent School Trust Fund Advisory Committee for the purpose of identifying potential lands as candidates for a partial exchange. And this working group effort was in response to a resolution that was passed by the Minnesota Legislature 2 years ago, which advocated for a two-thirds cash out of the lands in the Boundary Waters and a one-third land exchange. And the reason for this combined package was that for nearly 40 years, this thorny issue has failed to be resolved. And the failure has largely arisen because there exists a persistent disagreement about whether the land should be wholly sold to the federal government and the revenues invested, or wholly exchanged for land. This has been a persistent disagreement. So the one-third, two-third package represented a compromise, and by all accounts, the closest we have come in a generation to finding a solution. The language in the bill before you tonight calls for, once again, a one-sided solution, 100% exchange. And I feel certain that this will once again plunge the effort into controversy and disagreement and failure. My own group opposes an exchange of this magnitude. the public for over a generation has said such a large exchange is unpalatable. Because the public values the superior national forest for hunting and fishing and recreation and wildlife and the range of ecological functions that it provides. And moving 86,000 acres or more of land out of the Superior National Forest management and into high resource extraction management is not acceptable. Indeed, many of these lands are not appropriate for such kind of management. I urge the committee to reconsider, to reject this language that calls for 100% exchange, that we might at last find a responsible and lasting solution.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Dobb? Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Anybody else in the audience to speak for or against the bill? Any discussion to the bill? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a little amendment I thought maybe we could get agreement on. I'd to look on page 23. I'd like to move an oral amendment on line 23.30 after the word state to insert a period and then to strike 23.31, 23.32, 23.33.
Representative Hansen, I'm trying to figure out, you're from the Metro, this provision is from Representative Torkelson, I believe. Representative Torkelson, are you understanding, Representative, or do you want, why don't you speak to your amendment, Representative Hansen?
Mr. Chair, and I think I spoke to this at a prior committee there, where the way that the law is now, it has members from the metropolitan area would not have any, no matter how qualified, there would never be more than six members on a 15-member board. I believe it's 15. What my purpose of my amendment would say that the members should be distributed across the state, and it doesn't put any limitations on where they're from, that they'll be chosen by merit. So perhaps, I wouldn't think this would happen, but the appointing authority could appoint 10 people from the rural area and 5 people from the metro, or 10 people from the metro and 5 people from the rural. But they would have to be distributed across the state. So I think that would be a fairer shot than what folks in the metro have now, where they can get between 4 and 6 and never have a majority, even though the population majority is in the metropolitan area.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure how to interpret the words distributed across the state. I don't know if, you know, does that mean distributed by area or population?
Representative Hansen, or if you've got an opinion on it, it's current law.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the distributed across the state with a period after it would be up to the appointing authority, and that they could, you know, if there's a consequence, whatever, whoever the governor is, they would be wanting to balance them across, distribute them across the state. So they could choose on the best merit rather than limiting the potential membership within the metro area.
Representative Torkelson, any comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't really have a comment, but I believe the language was there to avoid domination by the metro members that may represent a larger population, but certainly represent a smaller geographic area.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would speak against the amendment. I think there is wisdom in the existing language that is there. Ostensibly, it was created in order to ensure that the people who are on the land and closest to the land are the ones who are best represented on this board. certainly the danger exists that people from the metro area could end up in Fillmore County. Representative Hansen, you know, dictating to folks down there. I'm trying to remember exactly what this board does, but it appears to me, and I do see their Soil and Water Conservation District supervisors in this. But I would speak against the amendment.
Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's the Bowser Board. It's the distributor of the money. Not just the general fund money, but millions of dollars of clean water money. So perhaps, you know, you would have people who are, through experience or education or a combination of both, extremely well qualified, but oops, they can't get appointed because they don't live. They, let's say they're a Dakota County Township officer who has a lifetime of experience in soil and water management, but oops, they're in Dakota County, so they can't get appointed because they're already at six. So the purpose of my amendment is to say we should have distribution across the state, but based on merit, rather than limiting where 6 out of 15 is the maximum you could have from the metropolitan area. How would it be if we did the opposite? If we said no more than 6 could be from the rural areas?
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Ms. Blackburn, I'm going to ask you to come down. This is your Bowser Board. And maybe a couple things, if you happen to know the current makeup, what would be affected by this? Well, actually, I'm assuming there would be no effect immediately because they would all qualify. And do you, if you could elaborate to if you've been able to digest Representative Hansen's oral amendment.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I'm sorry, I don't have the amendment, and I was a little distracted with WACA.
Ms. Blackburn, it's on page 23. Do you have the bill in front of you?
Mm-hmm.
On page 23, Representative Hansen has moved to delete lines 31 and 32. Hansen has moved to delete lines 31 and 32 that are not already stricken in 32. And he puts a period after the word state on line 30. Take a minute to digest it.
Mr. Chair and committee members, as far as the recommendation for what we had suggested for deleting, and that was part of Representative Torkelson's bill, the reason why we wanted that deleted was primarily to make sure that we weren't tied to the administrative regions of an association that defines things on their own. As far as the distribution of metropolitan versus rural versus where our representatives come from, again, I really didn't hear Representative Hansen's argument, and I apologize for that. I really didn't know we were talking about this at the time. I think that we need to make sure that there is a balance of both metro and rural interests. I think any time you come up with a particular number, there's always going to be an argument for or against it. I believe that because of the way that our distribution of funds goes across the state, achieving a balance is really important. But what is that number? We have 15 folks that represent units of government and citizens. Three are citizens. The rest of them make up units of government from counties, soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, cities and townships. It has become difficult sometimes to make sure that out of each one of those constituent groups or local units of government that we do have an even distribution that represents both state and rural. I mean, it's actually kind of a math equation, and we make dots all over our maps to make sure we're getting representation. I don't know what the magic number is. The board increased by 3 2 years ago. That's when we got the cities and townships on our board. So this number was based on having a 17-member board, and now we have a 20-member board. There was no adjustment at that time. I don't know whether that needs to be looked at or not. We have not actually looked at that distribution as far as an agency to make a recommendation. So I'm not able to make a specific recommendation at this time. We actually just have not looked at that as a requirement.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Blackburn, how many members from the metro area are on the board at this time?
Ms. Blackburn.
Well, it's difficult for me to say because we just had three that went off of our board, and we haven't had the new appointments made yet. And, you know, I'd have to go look at my list of where people are at right now. I don't remember specifically which three of our board members' terms expired. We haven't had the new appointments yet.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you had any difficulty finding qualified people or finding people from the correct categories that are listed here?
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, no, we have not. Most of the time, the associations for each of those units of government makes recommendations to the governor, and the governor appoints. We have not had any difficulty finding qualified individuals.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you had any complaints about the makeup of the board from the citizens that are involved with these issues?
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, I think any board is open to criticism based on any decision that they make, because the decision you make is always going to make somebody be viewed as not being a beneficiary of that decision, and I think boards are very used to that.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. I was not referring to the decisions, but to the makeup of the board. Have you had any complaints about the makeup, the variety of citizens we have designated here to make up the board?
Ms. Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, not that I'm aware of. I know that there were criticisms. That's why cities and townships tried to get on there, and they fought for a number of years in order to get on. The Bowser's work and the Watershed District work in the metropolitan area has a lot of impact on cities, and so they fought for a long time and got on there, as did townships. And so I think we haven't heard any criticisms since that time about the makeup of the board.
Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Blackburn, as I look at this, there's actually 20 members on the board. There's 15 in items 1 through 6, and then there's another 5. I'm curious, is the Commissioner of Agriculture, the Commissioner of Health, the Commissioner of Natural Resources, the Commissioner of Pollution Control Agency, and the Director of the University of Minnesota Extension Service, do they live in the metropolitan area or the rural area?
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I do not have their addresses.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would tend to expect, knowing some of these individuals in past positions, the propensity for them to be residents of the metropolitan area already. So that's going to add additional metro folks onto those already 4 to 6 on the board, bringing it to potentially 10 or half the board right there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, though, Representative Drazkowski, those members are representing their agencies. They're not being representing an interest group that is a local unit of government or our citizens. And I think, Ms. Blackburn, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but when the number was adjusted up a few years ago, the between four and six was not adjusted at that time to account for the increase in number. But the 4 to 6 was based on the lower number prior to that adjustment up. Is that what I think I heard you said?
Director Blackburn.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I believe that's correct. Going from memory, that's what I think. I probably should verify that in the record.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, so we just went through redistricting and reapportionment, folks. The state's changing and the population changes and our governance changes to reflect the population. And although the money, much of the money may be going out to greater Minnesota, most of it's raised in metropolitan area. And so, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call on this amendment.
Roll call has been requested. Additional discussion to the amendment. Clerk will call the roll. McNamara?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Beard?
Nay.
Dill? Druskowski?
No.
Fabian? Falk?
No.
Hackbarth?
No.
Hancock? Hansen?
Yes.
Hilty? Knuth?
Yes.
Purcell?
No.
Quam? Scott?
No.
Torkelson?
No.
Wagenius?
Yes.
There being three ayes and nine nays, the amendment is not adopted. Mr. Morris, I believe you had asked to testify.
And thank you for the opportunity. Sorry I wasn't in the room earlier. I do have a letter I'd like to distribute and then a few comments to make. And the,
you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Steve Morse. I am executive director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. And as you may know, the MEP, the Environmental Partnership, is the state's largest coalition of environmental and conservation groups. Together, our more than 75 coalition members and supporters work for clean water, clean energy, and investments in Minnesota's great outdoors through policy, education, and community events. Combined membership of our groups is over 450,000 Minnesotans. I specifically would like to address a number of issues that are in the bill before you in 2164, where I believe we are on the agenda, and I'm sorry I just came in. And although there are many issues that greatly concern us and our membership, I'd like to just highlight a few of them today. I would like to speak against the proposal and ask that it not be supported. Specifically, I'd like to mention a couple of areas, the sections 3 and 82, which refer, and this is in the, I believe it's the D1 amendment, the delete all amendment that came in earlier today. And before I just touch on that, I know I've had an opportunity to testify before this committee a couple of times, I believe. And I think most of you are aware that I spent some time here in this body, well, in the Senate, in the legislative body, but on the Senate side, but also in the DNR as deputy commissioner for 4 years. So some of these issues actually relate directly to my experience also on the administrative side. And I'd like to comment that the automatic permit approval, we think, is a really bad idea, and a few reasons why we think it's bad. Again, let's step back a little bit and think about what we're permitting here. We are permitting to control and reduce and limit pollution into our air and our water. These aren't permits to operate as much as they are permits to pollute. Minnesotans overwhelmingly want this pollution reduced, and that means an effective agency permit system. We believe agency staff are the experts on these issues, and we must rely on their expertise to evaluate, assess the impacts, and to set the limits that we'll allow here as a state. Our coalition believes this bill rolls back permitting and violates public accountability for regulatory permitting. We believe that it prevents updating permits with new technology as needed, that it prevents agency public review of a permit of changes in permit discharges, and forces agencies to perhaps focus on minor permits at the expense of bigger facilities. The auto permitting provision introduces opportunities for mischief into the system. For example, maybe agencies will just run out the clock rather than making a hard decision. Maybe they'll just be forced to make denials because they haven't had time to look at them, and so the way to stop the process is to just deny them. And certainly, it opens up the whole process for legal challenge, both for due process as well as the validation of a permit that may be automatically issued simply because it really effectively hasn't had agency review. And the agency is the delegated authority for our federal air and water programs. Sections 26 and also in the A1 amendment, the mineral lease authority from the Land Exchange Board. We believe that removing authority from the executive council
While there are pending issues on the table, it is not fair to citizens who are participating in good faith in this process. As someone who has worked before with the council on leasing issues in the past, I can tell you that it really brings an important balance to this overall system that we have. We strongly suggest you don't make such long-term policy decisions because of any particular action or your alignment with any current members. Remember, these two will change, just like all of us will. The land exchange amendment is a significant departure from what stakeholders have talked about. The land exchange amendment is also a significant departure from the stakeholders process that has been in process over the last couple of years. A number of our members have participated in that process, and I know some of them have testified, so I won't say anything more on that. On the executive council, as you know, last year the DNR auctioned off a number of mineral leases, and landowners objected, but they brought their concerns to a legitimate body. This bill would eliminate that check on the DNR and the mining companies and take away a remedy and a forum for property owners to assert their rights before statewide elected officials. I would think we wouldn't want to take away an opportunity for statewide elected officials to have a final review on this. For a legislature that I know has an interest in private property rights, especially as it relates to the use of government power, it seems perhaps a little bit inconsistent to take away this oversight role. Another area of concern is Section 64, where you deal with water quality standards stricter than the federal standards. We also would call this the dumbing down provision. This really doesn't make any sense, as we see it, because there are no federal water quality standards per se. Under the Clean Water Act, for example, federal government sets overall outcomes, sets some guidelines, but it's the state that actually sets the standards. The feds do not set minimums and maximums. There are non-binding guidelines and not enforceable standards. In addition, there are many state water quality standards where there are no federal standards. The federal law wants us to get to the outcomes of swimmable, fishable waters. And you know what? I believe this committee, and certainly overwhelmingly the vast majority of Minnesotans, agree with that. The task for the state agency is to develop the standards, the enforceable standards, to get us to that goal. This would prevent MPCA from taking actions also on toxics when they are found in Minnesota that are not included currently in any type of federal guideline. And lastly, I'd like to touch on the provision, Section 80, that removes the MPCA Citizen Board authority over environmental review. The MPCA Citizen Board provides an opportunity for all interested parties to be heard. It's, again, kind of a last check on the whole process, if you will. This provision eliminates a public forum for environmental review and exceptions to state rules, and that closes off public access to decision makers. The Citizen Board was established in the early days of the creation of the Pollution Control Agency to guard against the powers of money, influence, and inertia controlling the protection of our great outdoors, including significant permit decisions. It's there as a check, a final check on the process. This bill removes this citizen check for many key questions that will really define the future of our air, land, and water. Less public process, less citizen check. In closing, the public opposes such rollbacks to the laws that are in place to protect our health, our drinking water, and the air we breathe. As we have discussed before this committee earlier, voters across the entire state and all political parties oppose the type of environmental rollbacks contained in this legislation. We ask the members to oppose this bill that rolls back laws that protect our land, our air, and our water for our future generations. Thank you. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. I do not see any questions. Thank you. Additional discussion to the bill. Representative Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm on page 14. Section 18, I think we're kind of decriminalizing some actions here, violations of rules and laws relating to destruction of I guess I asked earlier who would speak for the trees. Here we're decriminalizing or reducing the penalties for willfully affecting trees and shrubs and plants and furniture and buildings and things at the outdoor recreation units. Is that a correct reading there, in council, or that we're going from a misdemeanor down to a petty misdemeanor?
As Ms. Taylor answers, I'm going to ask the Lieutenant Colonel to come down to the testifying table. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, if you read the language, it appears to be the case. I know when the DNR testified, they had stated something about the wanting to align the actual fees with the level of violation, so they may want to speak.
Thank you. Representative Hansen, this language is from the DNR, so we can let Director Smith welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Colonel Rodman Smith, Assistant Director of Enforcement for the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, what this is doing is this is kind of bringing in line these state recreation areas, units established, and bringing those penalties associated that are contained inside those rec areas into a petty misdemeanor. And so some of them are currently petty misdemeanors. There's kind of a hodgepodge a little bit because you're taking some in the state rec areas, you're taking some wildlife management areas, some state park lands now, and some SNA land, and you're grouping them under a group now of an SNA. And so there's different criminal penalty provisions with the different groups, and we're trying to formalize those all into a petty misdemeanor other than those that are on a wildlife management area.
Representative Hansen, I wanted to clarify one thing. Lieutenant Colonel, you said SNA. Did you mean SRA, or are we talking about SNA?
Some SNAs, Mr. Chair, scientific natural areas, can be contained within a SRA.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and maybe my memory is wrong, but didn't last summer during the Fourth of July weekend, didn't we have kind of campers go wild in some of the areas and willfully smash and destroy things? And if this provision were into effect, would they still be at a misdemeanor, or would they be at a petty misdemeanor for something like that?
Director Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, just to be clear, they weren't campers, they were vandals. They came into the park. They were not utilizing those areas as outdoor recreation areas. They were vandals, and they were charged with vandalism through the 609 criminal code. This would be more for some of those fairly minor things, like maybe defacing a sign in a state park. But the vandalism that happened during the shutdown, where they broke into buildings and they smashed windows, they'd still be charged under the criminal code 609, which would be depending on the level of damage that happened, anywhere from a misdemeanor to gross misdemeanor, and sometimes possibly a felony, depending on the amount of damage.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking at the, so we go into subdivision one, the horse pass looks like a petty misdemeanor. I think we get into some other violations here where we're removing penalties. I think on some of the aquatic invasive species, is that correct? We're taking away some penalties that are in existence now. Is it,
Director Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, are you still on Section 18?
I'm moving through the bill,
Hansen.
Mr. Chair. I'm moving through the bill trying to find the other section on AIS where I thought we had some penalties that were being stricken.
Representative Hansen, we did not include the increases that were proposed by the DNR. We did include the increase for repeat offenders. Ms. Taylor, if you could elaborate.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Hansen may be talking about the repealer. In the DE1, there is a repeal of the aquatic invasive species rules VCAL that was passed last year. If you want to look, it's on page 67, line 1, the repeal of 86B.508 and 86B.811, subdivision 1A.
Representative Hansen, I can speak to that. That's my repealer, and that's in an effort to get this bill through the Government Operations Committee. The Government Operations Committee, which is a real challenge and hurdle, and I'm continuing to work with members of my caucus on the importance of these stickers, and I'm hopeful I'm making headway. Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, you're the chair. I would.
Unfortunately, not of that committee.
It'll be interesting to watch as this moves forward. Ms. Taylor, is there anywhere else where we're reducing some of the changes that we made on AIS last year? For whatever reason, is there some other things with AIS that...
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, not that I'm aware of. There may be some small changes regarding bait and that kind of stuff that the DNR could speak to, but nothing to the effect of the violations like we've been talking about.
Representative Hansen, there is the winter bait issue, if I'm not mistaken. Lieutenant Colonel, is there not a winter bait issue in here in regards to AIS? A change that we're proposing, or am I wrong on that?
Mr. Chair, there was in the original department language, and let me see if I can find it here. In the, I believe it's still in here. Mr. Chair?
Director Smith, if you could give us a page number.
It'd be page 10, line 10.18. It wouldn't really be it's not a penalty provision. What it is a change in how bait is taken from waters and what it is exempting portable bait containers when fishing through the ice except on waters designated infested. So it's not a criminal change, or it's not. There's no penalty. There wasn't any penalty associated with this. Really, it's kind of a policy change.
So, Director Smith, if I get this right, you no longer would be requiring the ice fishermen to need to exchange their water if they were on a non-infested lake.
Mr. Chair, you're correct.
Okay, thank
you. On frozen waters.
Pardon me?
On frozen waters.
I think that's ice fishing, isn't it?
Yes, you are correct.
All right. Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, as long as Mr. Smith is here, I want to go back to that WMA or outdoor recreation piece, and I'm giving Representative Dill a little time here.
That's all right.
Last fall we had an incident where a landowner decided after interacting with the DNR that they were going to destroy hundreds of protected species. I'm talking about pelicans and pelican eggs, and that action was penalized through the federal government under the Lacey Act. But it's my understanding that there would have been state statute that would have applied as well. And it kind of gets into this issue of you have this body of law of enforcement that you could use, or you have this body of law of enforcement that you can use. And those pelicans were a state resource as well. But no action was taken, either administratively or civilly or any other way, to my knowledge. Is that correct?
Director Smith.
Through the state of Minnesota, that's correct.
Representative Hansen.
So, Mr. Chair, when we're changing other, I mean, I understand there's discretion by the executive on when to prosecute and when to move forward on things or to delegate up or down sometimes. But when we provide couple of options for the same thing, particularly when we're having the willful action, I get concerned about what is the public resource protection if the willful action is treated with a slap on the hand or no slap at all. So can you assure me on when we're dealing with these outdoor recreation, and the statute that's being changed is talking about willful destruction of trees, willful destruction of state property, that we're going to be going through the criminal route with vandalism, or are we going to have some petty misdemeanors if it's done on a WMA?
Director Smith.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, those are very good questions. I think that we would, as a department, need to better tease out, and if we could get back to the chair, I'd appreciate some time to talk with my cohorts in Parks and Trails in the Commissioner's office.
Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This kind of leads into the issue. I won't spend much time on it because we've talked about aquatic invasive species a lot, but the expectation that we would be moving forward on that issue in this bill, and unfortunately we're moving backward with the removing the decal, but the only thing that is looks like it could be more is that a repeat offender could have a double fine. The problem is our DNR has no way to know if people are repeat offenders. They do not have a computer system that allows them to know that. So I don't want people to think that we've done something here when it's not effective. I would hope that maybe DNR would come back to us next year and ask for a record management system that would allow us to know if somebody was a repeat offender. We don't know that now. It's one of the huge shortfalls. Everybody knows it out there. It doesn't make any difference. DNR's going to slap my hand this time and slap my hand next time, slap my hand a third time. Because we're not effective. And that seems to be one of the issues. So this is I hate to think that the Republicans are soft on crime, but wait, that's what it's looking like in this bill.
Representative Canute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we've talked about this bill or this provision before, but I'm just curious, and I'd like, again, another explanation maybe from Representative Torkelson or yourself on Section 64 on page 40, the water quality standards no more restrictive than federal standards. And I work on a lot of issues where people say, well, we'd rather just do it at the federal level. We'd rather just do it at the federal level. And I think I'm probably on the end of trusting the federal government a little bit more than other members of the body, but I'm just curious why we would want to basically give more authority to the federal government about the quality of waters and therefore I think the quality of life in Minnesota. I think this is a particularly troubling piece of this bill because it basically says the federal government has more power in the state of Minnesota, and so I'm just curious about the reasoning behind it.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would point out for everyone in the A1 amendment that we did add some more language to this section of the bill so that it is a little different than what was originally presented.
Representative Torkelson, remind us of the changes.
The added language on page 40, line 5, after 2012, insert, except upon showing by clear and convincing evidence that another standard is necessary protect the public use and benefit of the waters of the state. I believe this gives the state the out to put the standards, the state, if there are exceptional circumstances that the state could impose the standards necessary.
Representative Canute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I suppose that's a little better, but I know working on a lot of toxics policy and different emissions issues, pollution issues. I mean, I think that with the way our current law is, our agencies have that, or with us directing, they have that authority. And it just seems to me, by putting that language in here, you're just opening up agencies to potential litigation. And I don't think that's something anyone really wants in terms of wanting to litigate more about water quality standards. So I suppose it's a little better, but I still don't think it is necessary at all. I think Minnesota should just keep this authority and not make a higher standard to say what level of water quality we should expect to have as Minnesotans. I don't see any reason why we need to create a higher barrier for the state unnecessarily to protect its citizens from pollution and protect its water bodies from increased pollution.
Thank you, Representative Knute. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, actually, Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson. I think you've made it harder. Normally, the standard for something like this would be a preponderance of the evidence. And you've gone to clear and convincing. That is a terrifically high standard. When the court looks at that, it's really, really high. So I don't think we're making it softer. I think you're making it tougher.
Thank you. Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Ms. Chairman. And, you know, as I've been sitting here studying this bill, I am now going to propose an amendment. And it has to do with the continuing of government operations. It has to do with page 13, section 17, the state parks. It has to do with section 20, the zoo, on page 15. And I want you to note that it doesn't have anything to do with section 4, fishing and hunting licenses. So my motion would be to delete from the bill section 17 and 20 that have to do with the continuing operation of state parks and the continuing operation of zoos. Now, I think that each of you know that in my legislative district are some incredibly coveted and visited state parks. And makes me think about how I serve here. But in none of the cases of the state parks or the zoo does the Constitution, as exemplified in Article 13, Section 12, guarantee us the right to hunt and fish. And in the absence of fishing licenses and hunting licenses, in order to do it lawfully, we need to have fishing and hunting licenses, whether you're from the state or not from the state. But there are no place in the Constitution that talks about zoos, and we are actually taking the authority away from the courts in a time of a, like the government shutdown that we had, to determine what essential services are. And so my amendment, as I stated, would be to delete section 17 and 20 from the bill for the stated reason.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Representative Dill moves an oral amendment to delete section 17 and section 20 of the bill. Representative Dill, I'm going to oppose your amendment because in both cases, we were told last summer that the ongoing cash flow was positive for both of those operations, but because of the bureaucracy, they needed to close, even though they had more money coming in the door than was going out, and it just doesn't make common sense. Additional comments? Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to argue the point with you. I'm just, I think that as well as a legislator and as members elected in the House, Senate, and at the governor's office, that we need to continue to have leverage to be able to make a deal. And if we continue with these operations just because they're cash flow positive or cash flow negative, that might be 1 year or not the next year. That is an uncertain situation. But I remind you that I believe it was Senator Lessard who spent his entire career here trying to amend the Constitution for the right to hunt and fish. And so that is because I'm not deleting Section 4, and I appreciate your position on it.
I just think that we are, in this instance, stepping outside of the bounds of where we should be at. So that's what I have to say about it. Thank you.
Additional comment to the Dill Oral Amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Nay. The amendment's not adopted. I will renew my motion that House File 2164 as amended. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I just have to say that there's a lot of things in this bill that I can't support it. And if we really wanted to find some things that I think we could agree upon, we probably could. But there's just too many things here that are pushing way too far. And so I'm just curious as to what you expect the process to be, because I don't see a lot of strong bipartisan support for this bill. And so if you actually want to get something done, what is your plan going to be? Because we're going to have to find some way to come closer to consensus here. This is a lot of ideas. We've seen a lot of bills introduced. We haven't heard all that many Democratic ideas so far this year. Heard a few, but I think we could get stronger bipartisan consensus if we would have had a little bit more opportunity to go and have input into this bill, have some more of our bills heard. And I do think that there's a lot of areas here that are very controversial. And so once again, my question is as we move this out of our committee, we no longer have the ability to really control what's in it. Do you want to get a bill that we can actually agree to and maybe get signed into law, or what is your plan?
Representative Falk, it's our plan. We're next going to government operations and then ways and means and then onto the House floor. And as the bill proceeds, it's our hope that we will then confer with the Senate and the administration and get the bill passed and signed into law. Representative Falk.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wish you well in that endeavor, but I think it's going to be a very rocky road to get there. And that's going to be one of the challenges, because there's a lot of things in here that we have huge concerns with. And I don't think that we're starting off on a good pathway. So that's just, you know, my comments. I think that there are some good ideas here, but there's a lot of things that just showed up at the last minute that it makes it very difficult to get strong bipartisan support.
Well, Representative Falk, I think you make a good point that we do go down a rocky road, you know, very often. And hopefully as we go down this rocky road, we come to a conclusion that we are at a point where we can get bipartisan support. And I look forward to that. And if you've got additional thoughts, comments as it goes forward, I would appreciate that input, because this is a bill that we are hopeful to get in a form that will have more bipartisan support, more support from interest groups as we go forward and does get signed into law. And thank you for your comments. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to ask for a roll call.
Okay. Roll call has been requested.
And then
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have one follow-up. Representative Knuth was talking about the federal standards, and I know we go to the federal standards under the wetland protection, which I'm not sure if we can call it wetland protection anymore, but we're going to the 404, the Federal Clean Water Act. On pages, and I think that's on pages 35, 34, 33, I'd commented earlier about the metropolitan area, and the piece that's being deleted here is the references to wetland protection in the 11-county metro area. The reason these provisions were put in, and I'm specifically on 34.1 through 34.3, was to protect not to protect the small farmers, but to protect the wetlands from the nibbling away when there's development. And so I'm not sure if these wetland changes are for the little farmer. Also, I think this 11-county metro area, not the 7-county metro area, but the 11-county metro area was what the Republican Party lawyers used when this provision of law is citing that for redistricting, that
11 counties, the metropolitan area is 11 counties rather than 7 counties. So I find it curious that now after the redistricting's done, we'll eliminate that section of law that related to the metropolitan area as an 11-county area for the purposes of protection for wetlands. Finally, on page 29, line 29.34, striking the deed restriction on an altered wetland, and I actually have a deed restriction on a wetland with a under a wetland protection area of law. It's written in there. When I made a choice to enter into that, you know, none of us are immortal. When I entered into that deed restriction, I think it was before I was married and had children. That land could have been sold. Now it hopefully will be passed on, but that clarity as to the responsibility is there on the deed for the future. And so now we're striking the clarity that comes with having it written into the deed, and just open up the potential for converting land that was chosen to be protected. So I echo Representative Falk. A lot of stuff in here. Can't support it.
Thank you. Additional comment?
Clerk will call the roll.
McNamara?
Yes.
Anderson?
Yes.
Beard?
Aye.
Dill?
Aye.
Drazkowski?
Aye.
Fabian? Falk?
No.
Hackbarth?
Aye.
Hancock?
Aye.
Hansen?
No.
Hilty? Knuth?
No.
Purcell?
No.
Quam?
Aye, aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Torkelson?
Aye.
Wagenius?
No.
There being 10 ayes and 5 nays, the bill is passed as amended and on to government operations. We are adjourned.